Thanks, Coach Arcegos.
All right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the second marathon of our journey, second of many probably to come, but great to see everybody again. Just a couple quick announcements up front. It's a long day today. Hydrate, get some snacks, move around, get those legs moving. It's going to be a long meeting, and so thank you all for doing this. Thank you to all the viewers as well for joining us today. Farah, I know we've been through this many times. You all know the meeting procedures, but Farah, if you'd hit the high points and we can get underway.
Absolutely. Great. So just to walk everyone through, if we want to ensure another smooth and effective meeting, wanted to just provide brief reminders on some of the logistics and procedures. So of course, let's stay on mute when you're not speaking, reduce any background noise. We'll also try to ensure that folks who are not speaking are muted. We can move ahead to some of the slides that outline this. We would also encourage any council member to join us on video as and when you're able, and that can be clicked on and off using the camera button on your computer screen. To ask questions, we ask that you use the raise your hand function by using the hand icon on your screen. That will indicate you'd like to speak. And to get to that hand raise icon, you can click on the panelist participation button, which is marked off in a red box between the button with three dots and the button with the camera in the third visual on that slide. And when you are called, please go ahead and unmute yourself. And when you're done speaking, please place yourself back on mute. We do want to make sure that if there's any opportunity to go through person by person, that you are able to do so cleanly. And lastly, if you have any concerns from a technical perspective, feel free to reach us to nys.cac@cadmusgroup.com, and we will support you as best we can. Thanks, and back to you, Coachers.
Great. Thank you very much, Farah. Valerie from NYSERDA, can you do our roll call, please?
I'd be happy to. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Co-Chair Sagos. Good morning, council members and designees. When I call your name, please acknowledge your participation in today's Climate Action Council meeting. And I acknowledge the presence of Co-Chair Sagos, Co-Chair Harris.
Here. Good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner Ball.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Donna DeCarolis.
Good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner Dominguez.
Good morning.
Good morning. Gavin Donahue. I saw him earlier. We'll circle back.
I'm sorry. Good morning. I was on mute.
That's okay. Good morning, Gavin.
Good morning.
Dennis Elsenbeck.
Here.
CEO Falcone.
Good morning.
Good morning. President Gertler.
Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning. I just want to note that Rose Harvey will be joining us just a little bit later. Chair Hell.
Good morning, I'm here.
Bob Howard.
I'm here, thank you, good morning.
Great, good morning. Peter Iwanowicz.
Yes, I'm here, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Chancellor Malatros. Did I hear him? Well, sir, remember him from the tech check. CEO Quinones, I think I saw you earlier.
Present.
Great. Commissioner Reed may be on the phone at this point. She will be joining us also a little bit late. Ann Reynolds.
Here, good morning.
On behalf of Secretary Rosado, Sarah Crowell.
Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning. Raya Salter.
Here, good morning.
Good morning. Paul Shepson.
Good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner Fisnauskas.
Hi, good morning.
Hello. And on behalf of Commissioner Zucker, Henry Sleet. Good morning. Great, great. Given that, Council Co-Chairs, I need the presence of a quorum for today's Climate Action Council meeting.
Thank you, Valerie. Okay. Moving ahead, you all see the agenda for today. We'll go through the minutes, take a vote on that. Some brief remarks from both Doreen and myself. And then, of course, we get into the meat of the discussion, the panel of presentations, transportation, land use, local government, advisory panels. That'll take us up till noon. And then I switch the baton over to Doreen. She'll take up housing and energy efficiency, power gen, advisory panel recommendations. And then we'll get into some next steps looking ahead to June. As you all know, June, we'll be getting the recommendations on the adaptation and resilience group. We'll also have the Climate Justice Working Group with us to provide some feedback on their recommendations. And the integration analysis, very important integration analysis, is actually beginning now. Next slide, please. So raising for the council members, you all had a chance to look at the minutes from last month, maybe back one slide. Any questions, any discussion on the minutes from last month? If there are none.
Basil, this is Dennis Elsenbeck. I just note that I have a role change, and I have submitted that role change to the appropriate folks within both your organization and Doreen. So do you need that now or just later?
Okay. I didn't see that. Dennis, if you want to raise it now or we can...
Yeah. So I just need to change my role to president of Veriti Perante Incorporated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Got it. Thank you. Any other questions or comments on the minutes from last month? If there are none, can I have a motion to approve the minutes from last month?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. The motion carries. Now we'll advance it, and I will turn the baton quickly to Doreen.
Well, good morning, everyone, and it's great to see everyone bright and early today. If we turn to the next slide, just wanted to provide a quick recap of what was a pretty thrilling Earth Week here in New York State, as we are making substantial progress together toward the achievement of many of the goals of the Climate Act as we speak. So Earth Week 2021 featured an especially active whirlwind of announcements, launches, and events here in New York for many of the agencies and organizations reflected here on the council. And in fact, in my 10 plus years at NYSERDA, I personally have never witnessed an Earth Week like this one. We announced the launch of NYSERDA's Clean Transportation Prizes and support for municipal zero emission vehicles and infrastructure. DEC released draft regulations that significantly reduce and in many instances prohibit the venting of natural gas from oil and gas infrastructure, the latest action in support of Governor Cuomo's methane reduction plan. Another round of funding was made available to community-based organizations in communities historically and disproportionately impacted by pollution to fund projects that address environmental concerns. We released the 2019-2020 Greening New York State Report, which documents the continued progress made by state agencies and authorities to reduce the environmental footprint of our operations. And we also announced 10 real estate groups as partners in the state's $50 million Empire Buildings Challenge to establish public-private partnerships and usher in the next generation of high-rise, low-carbon buildings. And notably, and as you see here with Lieutenant Governor Hochul, NYSERDA also announced more than 20 large-scale renewable energy infrastructure projects that are commencing construction across the state this year, including the first utility-scale solar project to break ground in upstate New York. So this announcement coincided with the launch of the fifth annual solicitation for large-scale renewable projects to accelerate what is a rapid pace of clean energy deployment across the state. And finally, NYSERDA and Metro IIF and Block Power announced a $4 million grant to implement a large-scale clean energy campaign for faith-based community anchor institutions. So an action-packed Earth Week, and certainly more to come as we continue this rapid pace of deployment. Back to you, Basil, for our next check-in on our progress.
Great, Doreen. Thank you. Just a quick few words on the progress we've made thus far, and part of this is a thanks to the panel members. Next slide, please. We have been racing ahead, have been making great progress on the recommendations. You're getting the bulk of them today. You got some last month as well. We've had 65 public meetings from the panels, 24 public input sessions, and numerous other meetings, cross-panel meetings, and so forth. It's been a Herculean effort thus far, and I want to recognize the amount of work that's gone into this. It's all been volunteer work, so thank you. As I mentioned earlier, the integration analysis is going to be beginning. We'll be certainly discussing and checking in on that with everyone on a regular basis over the summer. I mentioned that adaptation resilience is going to come next month. And then once the integration analysis is rolling ahead, we'll be working on pulling together some of the draft chapters for the scoping plan, and we'll be presenting those to you for your review and feedback. So that will be the next real chunk of work that we do. Of course, throughout this process, the public is watching today. We welcome the public input on all of this. The standard email, of course, you can reach out to many of us, but the standard email is climateact@dec.ny.gov. It's the best and easiest way to provide feedback, but please, if you have feedback, please keep rolling that to us. But thank you. Again, the timeline here is again, very ambitious, but we are on track. It's not to say we don't have challenges ahead, but it's exciting to know that we've been able to do this over the last 18 months not to mention the pandemic. So next slide, please. So now we're going to get into the advisory panel recommendations. It'll follow the same format as last month. If you remember that, the chair will begin by discussing some of giving an overview of some of the work from the panel. And then, of course, we'll have that open discussion. We'll be a timekeeper on that. I'll do my best to do that. Maureen Letty's going to help. We'll have at least an hour of discussion after each of the panels, and that'll bring us right up to the noon break, where we'll split for lunch and come back together. You all know where we are. This is, again, relatively high level recommendations. There will be a great deal of work ahead on all of it. This is not the end of the line on any of these recommendations, but just another stage, of course, a very public stage and an airing of some of these great ideas. But we will have an additional time to review these and vet these in the future. So as not to delay any further, let's get right into it. If you could bring the next slide up, and I'll turn the microphone over to Commissioner Marie-Therese Dominguez from the DOT to talk about the Transportation Advisory Panel.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner Zegas. And thank you, President Doreen Harris. Before we begin today's presentation of the Transportation Advisory Panel recommendations, for the Climate Action Council to consider, I want to personally thank the panel members themselves and the staff for the incredible amount of work and their extraordinary dedication that they've put forward to really tackling these complex issues. So I just wanted to say a note of thanks from the get-go. Next slide, please. Next one. All right, just to give you a sense of how robust, we've got a very full transportation advisory panel membership, and I really do again thank everybody for their participation. Next slide, please. So despite the challenges faced by each and every one of us as a result of the ongoing health pandemic, I believe that the Transportation Advisory Panel has really conducted an open and very extensive public and stakeholder outreach process. thanks to technology and virtual meetings, the recommendations presented today have been informed through a variety of mechanisms, to include 12 open to the public meetings, 12 advisory panel meetings that we've had, 2 designated meetings for the public to provide comment on the development of the draft recommendations, 2 direct engagement sessions with the Climate Action Council, and cross-panel and work group discussions that have occurred in coordination with the Ag and Forestry panel, the Waste panel, Power Generation, Land Use and Local Government, Climate Justice, the Climate Justice Working Group, and the Just Transition Working Group. In addition, the panel members individually have had very spirited and impactful discussions and expressed their clear direction and their sentiment through the course of these many engagements. I'd also note that the delivery of recommendations for consideration to the council represents only a point in time along a spectrum towards the development of the larger scoping plan, which Commissioner Sagos referenced at the beginning of the meeting. Indeed, we have a lot of work ahead of us as we move forward on all of this. Next slide, please. So let's take a little bit of perspective on transportation writ large. I'd like to underscore the importance of the transportation sector as part of the solution to both of New York's goals. And those goals are aggressive climate action and economic competitiveness. And just taking a step for context, dating back to the earliest days, the evolution of transportation has served as a catalyst for economic growth. It's also served as a catalyst for productivity and land use and development patterns. In fact, transportation investments significantly influence where economic growth ensues and at what rate that growth occurs. The construction of roads, canals, seaports, airports, and railways in the 18th and 19th centuries really fueled New York's position as an global economic leader across the board. Most individuals look at New York and think of tourism and finance and insurance and real estate as the foundational economic drivers for the state. But as Agriculture Commissioner Ball can best attest, New York is also a national leader in agriculture and farming sectors as well. Through new investments in seaports, New York is shipping increased amounts of soy and other grain products to Asia and other global destinations. And the challenge before us today is how to balance that growth facilitated by transportation with mitigating harmful greenhouse gas emissions. Compounding this challenge are historically low fuel prices. Individual consumers are buying vehicles designed for longer distances to sustain primarily short trips. And innovations in commerce, such as just-in-time delivery and dispersion of product production facilities, has made commerce more cost-effective. However, the convergence of these examples illustrates the sustained decrease in trip efficiency while increasing the amount of discretionary vehicle miles traveled. The Transportation Advisory Panel approached the challenge of carbon neutrality strategically and with an eye towards recognizing the opportunity and the delicate balance of facilitating transportation's role in economic growth with the need to address adverse community, atmospheric, and human health impacts. The comprehensive recommendations developed by the Transportation Advisory Panel respect and adhere to the CLCPA framework. Having stated that, the Transportation Advisory Panel also recognizes that to fully implement the required CLCPA while maintaining the state's economic competitiveness, New York needs the support of complementary national and regional strategies. The panel's recommendations are also highly dependent upon a few key factors: encouraging robust community engagement, facilitating public-private partnerships, advancing regulatory and incentive-based strategies, continually reassessing strategies and technologies over time and adjusting as needed, developing new measures for transportation investment decisions, and promoting education and awareness that support personal travel behavior changes. Next slide. So we face a major challenge in reducing transportation emissions to meet our CLCPA targets. And the transportation sector, you can see by this slide, emissions grew consistently from 1990 to 2006, but have been declining since then. Emissions in 2018 were about 107 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent per year, based on CLCPA accounting rules. New York State has been working with the Cadmus Group to develop estimates of what the impacts of our transportation greenhouse gas reduction policies could be. And based on Cadmus's modeling, we expect that the policies recommended here could reduce New York's transportation emissions by about 23 million metric tons per year by 2030. This is about 16% below 1990 emission levels. The modeling further shows that the policies could reduce New York's transportation emissions by an additional 61 million metric tons per year by 2050 to 23 metric tons. This is a reduction of about 77% below 1990 emission levels. These reductions are impressive, but may fall slightly short of what may be needed from the transportation sector based on E3's pathway analysis. If that is in fact confirmed by the integration analysis, the panel may reassess alternatives for achieving our goals. Next slide. So, what are some of the mitigating strategies that we're talking about? For the purposes of today's discussion, we have aggregated the recommendations into four buckets that are demonstrated here. One, transitioning personal and commercial vehicles to electric and zero emission technologies and supporting cleaner renewable fuels for use in that transition and for hard to electrify transportation sectors. And number two, enhancing the availability, accessibility, reliability, and affordability of public transportation. Number three, aligning and integrating transportation investments into land use and development to mitigate carbon emissions. And number four, implementing market-based strategies to impact travel decisions and finance investments in clean transportation. Next slide, please. So how do we look at transitioning to zero emission vehicles? Converting the transportation sector to run primarily on zero emission technologies is one of the most impactful things that we can do to reduce transportation greenhouse gas emissions and other pollution. Zero emission transportation technologies includes both electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. These technologies are now available in a wide range of vehicle types, from light duty cars, SUVs and trucks, medium and heavy duty trucks and buses, and non-road vehicles like construction and lawn equipment. The panel, the Transportation Advisory Panel, recommends increasing sales of these vehicles through a combination of regulations requiring increased sales and market development activities to increase consumer demands for these vehicles. The panel recognizes differing viewpoints on some of the recommendations that will continue to be taken into consideration as the scoping plan proceeds. On the regulatory side, the advisory panel recommends that New York adopt the Clean Advanced Cars regulations, which would require an increasing percentage of cars that are sold to be zero emissions, up to 100% of new car sales by 2035. The advisory panel also recommends that New York adopt advanced clean truck regulations, which require an increasing percentage of truck sales to be zero emission, up to 100% by 2045, and regulations that accelerate zero emission vehicle sales among specific fleet types, like trucks at port facilities. These initiatives are consistent with recommendations that Governor Cuomo made last month in a letter to President Biden, where he was joined by 11 other governors. But regulations alone won't be enough to enable a seamless transition to zero emission vehicles. We will need to support the market through approaches like rebates and incentives, which can lower the purchase price of zero emission vehicles relative to gasoline and diesel vehicles. We will also need to invest in charging stations and hydrogen filling stations, and we'll need to reduce barriers to EV sales and maintenance. We'll also need to address rates to support EV adoption that also minimize impacts to the electric grid and increase consumer awareness. The Transportation Advisory Panel also recommends strategic investments in electrifying off-road vehicles, including construction equipment, farm equipment, airport ground support equipment, landscaping equipment, and small marine vessels, all through incentives, and implementing zero emission requirements for the state fleet and state contractors' fleets and equipment. We'll need to really look at how we best target policies to ensure that zero emission vehicles are deployed quickly in disadvantaged communities, where really they've borne the largest burden of transportation emissions to date. This includes enhanced incentives for lower income New Yorkers to buy new or used electric vehicles and targeting truck incentives to areas overburdened by vehicular pollution. Also important is a holistic approach in supporting workforce development and community ownership models to ensure that economic benefits from electrification flow to these communities. Next slide, please. Let's take a minute and talk about clean fuels. As you can see from this slide, our electrification policies will also eliminate gasoline consumption by 2050, which is seen in yellow here, and greatly reduce diesel consumption in black. But there's a significant delay in achieving these reductions as the fossil fuel fleet is retired over time. Even with very aggressive electrification, we will still be using fossil fuels for the coming three decades. Emissions from these fuels can be reduced in the interim with a clean fuel standard requiring the fuel industry to produce or utilize lower carbon fuels like renewable biofuels and electricity. These fuels can also be used for use in hard to electrify fields like aviation, maritime, and long distance trucking. Significantly, the clean fuel standard will also provide ample support for electrification, such as charging providers and utilities earned credits for the charging of vehicle batteries. The Public Service Commission can require the value of credits generated by electricity to be funneled back into support for electrification across the board. Next slide, please. Let's talk a minute about public transportation. One of the greatest opportunities to bridge the council's emphasis on energy efficiency, housing, and land use is just to strategically invest in high quality, high frequency public transportation services. For the purposes of today's discussion, the Transportation Advisory Panel is defining public transportation broadly to include transit, micro mobility like Uber, Lyft, Via, and even longer distance passenger rail services. New York's current public transportation services alone result in the state using the least energy per capita for transportation purposes than any state in the nation, and provide a net reduction of more than 17 million metric tons of carbon annually. Through incentivizing transportation-oriented development and mandating the coordination of transportation and land use plans and smart growth, we can increase the availability of public transportation, reduce the need for unproductive single-occupant trips, and mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. Investments in public transportation, however, must prioritize and transform infrastructure. That includes operations and accessibility to low and moderate income communities, including supporting first and last mile connectivity through safe pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure, deploying zero emission vehicles and fleets They're appropriate in size and in scale for the communities that they're serving, and creating targeted opportunities and investments in STEM initiatives to really support the new technology and the fleets. We also need to look at increasing the number of destinations that are accessible by bus and rail, and walking and biking. We also need to look at the service frequency, the reliability, and the hours of operations. And we need to look at increasing the responsiveness and the number of mobility options, whether that's microtransit or micromobility. We also need to look at providing high-quality amenities at public transportation facilities and stops, and accelerating new technologies that provide real-time schedules and make transit truly easier to use for everyone. The council may want to consider strategies that facilitate smart growth and disincentivize auto dependency and congestion through area pricing and parking strategies with a goal towards reducing unproductive trips. As new zero emission technologies evolve, the panel also recommends investigating hydrogen fuel cell bus technologies. Next slide. Let's take on our other significant bucket here, which is smart growth and land use. Smart growth and land use patterns reduce auto use, or VMT, and help us reach our transportation goals for reduced greenhouse gas emissions. Generally, smart growth integrates the three E's, which are actually expanded to a fourth E. The three E's are economic concerns, equity, and the environment, and increasingly the emergence of energy. More specifically, we're talking about compact, mixed use, diverse, mixed income communities that are walkable, bikeable, and transit accessible, and that can offer safe and accessible public places and accessibility to outdoor spaces as well. But with smart growth, you just know it really when you see it. And so that's why we've given you some pictures here to kind of bring home the point. So if you look at the top picture, the before and after. On the before picture, the top is really clearly not a smart growth pattern. For our purposes, it also does not help us in reducing VMT and GHG emissions. There's only one form of mobility, as demonstrated in the before picture, and that's really the reliance on the car. And land use really is focused in this example on spreading out, sprawling kind of land use policy. There's not a lot of mixed use here, and the low density and streetscape configuration doesn't really support transit options here. But fortunately, in New York, our policies are moving us closer to the second picture here, which is the after picture. And that is a community that is more climate friendly. As you can see, there are several mobility options. Walking in the second picture here in the after picture, it demonstrates the walkability, biking, transit, the density and mix of uses that are provided, given that critical mass is really necessary to support an investment in transit. And there's plenty of greenery, which is great because that looks at absorbing carbon and reducing, you know, what's known as the urban heat island effect. We've worked closely with our colleagues on the land use and local government advisory panel because land use and transportation outcomes are inextricably tied. They influence one another in a very, very cyclical way to either enable sprawl or enable smart growth. And obviously our goal is more smart growth. We're trying to create a mutually reinforcing cycle that supports smart growth. But we're often confronting past investments and policies that support sprawl. So we're cross-endorsing the land use and local government recommendations to support transit-oriented development rather but expanding on that to really make it transportation-oriented development, which is basically concentrating smart growth within a half-mile radius of a rail or a bus station. We're not going to reach our VMT reduction goals if we're only addressing that limited geographic scope. So we've coined the phrase, as I mentioned, transportation-oriented development to ensure that we align our transportation goals and investments, especially around public transportation, with land use outcomes on corridor-wide and multi-municipal scale investments. Put simply, we can't achieve our goal of significantly expanding public transportation without complementary smart growth and land use policies at the state and local levels. The words alignment and coordination came up frequently during the course of our discussion, particularly in a regional context, and you can see why. So some of our recommendations seek to bring together the major stakeholders early in our process and transit agencies. And we've really looked at how we can best support smart growth and public transportation through a transportation-oriented development process. This really does realize the CLCPA's vision for greater social economic equity. Aside from reducing transportation-based air pollution, our recommendations enable more affordable and mixed-income housing that is accessible to transit and other mobility options. And in doing so, we are working to address the disproportionate amount of time and money that lower-income households spend on transportation. Smart growth also enables greater outdoor activities and access to fresh, nutritious local food and health services, which addresses the public health disparities endemic in lower-income communities. We were often reminded that all of our recommendations, when implemented, must recognize that there's no one-size-fits-all formula for smart growth. We must adapt the basic formula to vastly different conditions in rural, suburban, and urban communities, with particular attention to disadvantaged communities. Excuse me.
Trace, you okay?
Apologies. When you said hydrate, you really meant it.
Everyone take a breath. Everyone breathe.
Sorry about that. Okay. So next slide, please. All right, let's talk about our third big bucket here, which is market-based strategies. Most of the strategies we've discussed will need significant public investment, and the panel evaluated a number of strategies to fund clean transportation and really recommends that the council consider a few strategies that will both reduce emissions directly and provide funding to implement the other strategies that we've discussed. The Transportation Advisory Panel recognizes that market-based pricing mechanisms are needed to achieve CLCPA goals. And in that regard, the panel recommends participation in the Regional Transportation Climate Initiative, otherwise known as the TCI program, as part of a regional and national approach. That would cap and reduce transportation emissions across the region by close to 25%. By 2030, while also raising some revenues for investment in electrification and public transportation, with a priority for investment in disadvantaged communities. The Transportation Advisory Panel discussed economy-wide legislation over TCI, and the CAC, of course, may choose to go in that direction, in which case TCI could be considered as part of an economy-wide approach. So I wanted to put that all out there. I think it's important. Other potential funding strategies identified by the panel include congestion pricing, which is very important to discourage driving into congested downtown areas, and obviously something New York is firmly putting on the table. Pricing parking to encourage other modes of transportation, and increased registration fees for high emission vehicles, which are similar to the fee-based concept that I mentioned earlier. In the longer term, pricing of vehicle miles traveled should be explored as a replacement for or supplement to the gasoline tax as we phase out the use of liquid fuels. And the panel also recognizes that there's a very important role for private financing. Funding provided by these market-based programs can be used to leverage private financing of clean transportation, particularly for fleet electrification and EV infrastructure. There's a number of models to work from, including but not limited to those used by New York's Green Bank. So I think this is an ever-evolving area for us to continue to look at. All right, next slide, please. Let's look at the consolidated benefits of all of these recommendations. As I stated earlier, the Transportation Advisory Panel's recommendations adhere to and advance the aggressive goals established by the CLCPA. In the aggregate, the package of recommendations submitted for consideration really does look at promoting equity and inclusion through a series of things involving low and moderate income communities and investment decisions, policy development and program implementation, really looking at investing in alternative modes of transportation, whether that's transit, walking, biking, all in collaboration with integrated land use development, and supporting emerging workforce training and development opportunities. These are all critical and all go hand in glove. In addition, the recommendations also look at prioritizing investments in low and moderate income communities through targeting investments to accelerate the deployment of zero emission vehicles and commercial fleets, thereby mitigating harmful health impacts. Also through driving innovation, carbon neutrality in the transportation sector will support economic opportunity and growth in all communities across the board, as well as implementing strategies that maximize flexibility, minimize costs for transportation related businesses and developers to help grow employment opportunities. And lastly, these market-based approaches that we're talking about really do incentivize alternatives and generate revenues to support the greening of transportation infrastructure writ large. They also facilitate collaboration between the public and the private entities that are involved here and generate revenues to support all of these policies and programs. And lastly, it really does build upon New York's nation-leading commitment to climate change and to climate leadership in particular. So I think we've given a very holistic view of all of the segments that the Transportation Advisory panel has taken on. I really thank everybody for the opportunity. Again, want to thank, this is not the end of the road here for our Transportation Advisory panel members and the great team that's been working on this, but certainly, really appreciate their assistance getting us to this step in the process here, and appreciate the opportunity to present these recommendations to the larger CAC. So thank you all very much.
Great, Marie Joyce, thanks very much. Maureen Light, where are we on time right now?
We are right on time.
Okay. Great. So before we get into land use and local government, I think we're going to set aside some time now. What do we have, 60 minutes, Maureen?
That's correct.
Okay, 60 minutes to dive deep into transportation. Again, raise your hand there in the little button. I see Dennis. Dennis, take it away.
Thanks, Basil. So as usual, very, very comprehensive overview. I did read your more voluminous report, which I appreciated greatly getting that in advance. And one of the items that struck me was under the low carbon modes mitigation strategy, that just transition businesses and industry workers, it was stated As jobs move and change in the transition to a clean energy economy, businesses will need to accommodate their employees' commuting needs. The reality is that already exists today, and especially in our Rust Belt communities, it's really trying to look at how do we reverse that trend. And I think what I didn't see enough of, and maybe it's just requires further exploration, is smart growth also indicates economic development backfill, meaning that instead of thinking about how do I move my folks out of their neighborhood, how do I start thinking about bringing clean tech opportunities to the neighborhood? And then developing workforce training and development around that type of a scenario. And one of the things I didn't notice throughout the document is ESD is not really part of, except for, let's say, developing different routes. ESD should be dramatically involved in how do we actually create these clean tech jobs within our Rust Belt communities, which happen to also relate to our disadvantaged communities. So I was concerned that from a smart growth point of view, we're missing this economic development backfill, which I think is really critical, because it's really nice that we're funding a lot of this new transportation sector. But the people who are really benefiting are the companies, the states, the countries that actually develop those products. So we need to think about some of those incentives that are actually borne by ratepayers. How do we reinvest in clean manufacturing or clean tech within New York so that it's New York that is developing the manufacturing or the production value proposition that we then can compete with other states and other countries on the global scale. So just I'm trying to think of this as bigger. So, you know, if we look at clean energy funding, you know, how many sustainable jobs are created? What's the economic impact that was created? What percentage of purchase solutions are built here in New York? How did the impact of smart growth, especially in disadvantaged communities, you know, are we creating those type of opportunities so that people in those neighborhoods do have a walkable environment so that they can walk to work, which was the original design of most of our Rust Belt neighborhoods? I just think it gives us a much broader vision of what we can accomplish. The second thing is about infrastructure, and I do overemphasize this because I keep trying to make sure that we're looking at infrastructure in its totality. That means, do I have local infrastructure in order to support these type of initiatives? And do those infrastructure issues not only include transportation, but the buildings moved to decarbonization, and what are the local economic development needs? Our Rust Belt communities, and I'll generalize this, do not have the right infrastructure, nor do they have electric capacity to develop this type of economic opportunity. And I just think we need a broader view. I think we need the utilities to be able to point out where our hotspots are so that we're not waiting until we develop a clean energy transportation, clean energy buildings, and then the need for economic development, and then oops, discover I don't have the infrastructure in place to accommodate, which means a whole new series of filings on a go-forward basis. The last thing I just want to say, and it's not something that it's just because I'm a New Yorker, but there's always a lot of references to California, what California's doing, and it's all about, boy, they provide some cool guidance. Well, can I tell you, I'm not that impressed with their energy policy. An energy policy that, when they ran into demand side issues, asked businesses to shut down for days, if not weeks. They've asked their residential during the highest temperature period to shut down their air conditioning. And oh, by the way, in terms of transportation, they asked those with electric vehicles to stop charging. That's not good business practice. We can develop a better balance between environmental sustainability and business, and I think we got to incorporate that in our recommendations. Thank you, Basil.
Okay. So, Dennis, I really appreciate your thoughtful comments. I want to go back to the first point that you raised with regard to smart growth. One of the things that, if I didn't make it very clear, one of the things that that the Transportation Advisory Panel and the Department of Transportation in particular are looking at very focused way. And what we talked about is this larger notion of not just transit-oriented development, but transportation-oriented development. So that what we're looking at is the smart growth strategies that are linked not only to communities, but have that economic development component to them. So when we work with the downtown revitalization initiatives and the REDC and all of the things that all of the state agencies that come to the table, not just ESD has a huge component of that, but all of the state agencies that are involved in working with the local communities on those revitalization initiatives, transportation is often the key component of that. So an example of that right now is if you go to Oswego, looking at the downtown revitalization dollars that have been put in there, it's become much more walkable, bikeable, pedestrian friendly, and it's led to additional economic development opportunities. And as they invest in that level of growth in revitalizing their core economic demand, and talk about a Rust Belt town here in New York, you've got everything from port activities to to businesses that are being spurred to develop as a result of and housing opportunities as a result of that level of investment. And that's just a small segment of where we can go. And if we look at all of the revitalization opportunities in a smart growth and a transportation-oriented development mindset, so that we're integrating all of these opportunities for transit in particular, but also just reducing VMT writ large. I think this is the kind of match that we're looking at, and just to give a specific New York example, same thing in Rochester, same thing in Buffalo, where we're looking at how do we match that level of investment with these clean strategies that get us to our overall GHG emission reduction goals.
My point was is that some of those incentives and plans really should be targeted towards total job growth in
Correct.
That sector is my point. Not that I'm creating new routes and then, sometime down the road, people will build something there. That should actually be part of our integrated strategy.
So we hear you loud and clear. Measuring those metrics, I think, and bringing them to the table, is actually really important. So we hear you, and I'm not disagreeing in any way. I think it's a really critical piece of it. So thank you. And on the California issues, I will tell you that we're looking at what they've learned from what they've done. Not necessarily copying them writ large, but they've been doing it a little bit longer. What can we learn from what they've done? Not necessarily applying it wholesale.
Okay, thanks, Dennis. Raya.
Hello, thank you so much. Again, a lot of excellent ideas, a tremendous amount of work. Thank you so very much for that. I've got a couple questions and I'll be quick in asking them. And first is, how will these recommendations ensure that populations are benefiting and adverse impacts aren't happening in disadvantaged communities and elsewhere? We know that in California, Cap and Invest has not always resulted in benefits. So will these recommendations include accountability, protections, and metrics, and how? And my second question is, we know that TCI is controversial to many. There are diverse opinions. So were there minority opinions in the TCI recommendations and other recommendations here? And if so, what were they?
So we know that a few members of the Climate Justice Working Group have expressed concern to the market-based programs, including TCI, and at least one panel member who was with an environmental justice organization, indicated a preference for the CCIA legislation, and very much understand and appreciate that. I think that the panel has envisioned TCI as a way of really looking at it as a funding strategy that that actually benefit LMI communities, such as incentives for the purchase of electric trucks, you know, and other vehicles that are really targeted. And under the CLCPA, at least 35 to 40% of the investments have to benefit directly disadvantaged communities. So we really want to continue our work with the Climate Justice Working Group, and we'll do that as we go into the June CAC meeting. But the larger view of it is really to make sure that we, as we develop these potential strategies, that really we really do continue to listen and look and learn and make sure that we're integrating as best we can.
Yeah, and Rita Race, I mean, just to play off that a little bit, I mean, it is going to be incumbent upon us as a Climate Action Council to ensure that we're hitting the targets in the law in terms of ensuring that the benefits are actually directed into communities. That is something that we'll have to take up. That will be part of the rulemaking processes, any legislation in the future, and so forth. So, I don't know that the transportation panel has fully fleshed out how those dollars will be directed whatever source, but that they have to be, we understand they have to be.
Right.
Yeah, that's I hear you. I think what I'm encouraging every panel to, and you know, to do as we work to put those markers in the plan is help us develop those metrics and those markers, because we're not going to be able to, you know, that every agency needs to be recommending sort of how do they see the best way to see, you know, what progress will look like. And so that's personally what I hope to see encouraged.
Thank you, Raya. Definitely. Those markers, the 35 to 40% investments really, you know, benefiting LMI communities, those and the metrics that you're talking about, those, we are taking those very seriously. So we'll look to do that. Thank you.
Okay, Raya, if you're done, I'll move to Anne.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. Thanks so much for that presentation, Commissioner. Lots of great information. I wanted to make a comment about money. So it was somewhat related to the last discussion, but like many of the folks at the agencies here and probably others on the council, this is my third time around with a climate planning initiative in New York State. There was one in about 2004. I hope I get the years right, with Governor Pataki. And there's another in 2010 with a comprehensive climate plan developed, and good things happened as a result of those. But I will say that all of these really great recommendations for transportation were brought up at that time too. And it is actually relatively uncontroversial, because no one is opposed to public transit, to transit-oriented development, to smart growth, I mean, largely speaking. They're all wonderful ideas, but the missing element, the other times around, has been a dedicated source of revenue to pay for this. And I wanted to reiterate one of the things you said. So I'm quoting you from a few moments ago, saying that the regulations alone are not enough to provide for a smooth transition. We could do the regs. I hope we do the regs for both light duty vehicles and medium and heavy duty vehicles, and stay consistent with California, although we are limited to what California does. So if there's any change there, we wouldn't be able to adopt those regulations to get all the way there because of the Federal Clean Air Act. But it is really important that we have a dedicated source of revenue. So I'm happy that the TCI recommendation was mentioned. I personally think that it's a a good measure because it's not just a source of revenue, it's also a cap on emissions. But it's also done with our neighboring states. Hopefully as many of them as possible could join in. If there was another way to get that dedicated revenue, either legislatively or through some other means, I think that would be good too, but I think the TCI is an opportunity in front of us. I just can't say strongly enough that unless these recommendations include some very specific dedicated source of revenue, I'd be afraid that all of these wonderful ideas can't come to fruition.
Well, thank you. I recognize that, you know, one of the things that we're looking at is there's not a one solution for a pay for on all of this. And it's got to be a mix of things, which is why I referenced that as well. So we're looking at a series of investments. How do you actually, you know, one thing builds upon another. That's why I talked about the green bank strategies and what we're looking at. But in addition to that, you know, it allows us potentially to leverage some of these investments into public-private partnerships in different ways. But any new revenue streams, you know, would really need to be something that we take on holistically. Also something that, you know, obviously the executive and the legislature would take on, but understanding that that, you know, there are many ways to peel this onion, but how we go about it needs to continue to be very thoughtful. So,
yeah, I think that's wise. I think having more than one option is smart. So all the eggs aren't in one basket, but I think keeping our eye on whether it's through the low carbon fuel standard and having some private investment or TCI or an identified carbon charge, just being realistic that without those sources of dedicated revenue, we can't get there. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in here with one point from the council's perspective, I think this is a really important topic for the council to be taking up as well through the coming months as part of this integration analysis, but also really looking at these recommendations together. Admittedly, different strategies may benefit from different approaches, as Commissioner Dominguez just described. But also, and toward the end of the meeting, I'll talk about a way we're thinking about addressing this critical topic of finance, finance which comes in multiple forms as a council in the coming months as well. So just something to preview for later.
So I just want to say thanks to Doreen for teeing that up, because it really is, you're raising a very significant issue, Anne, and one that's not lost, certainly. I've talked with my fellow commissioners about this as well, on how do we pay for this in a thoughtful, smart, you know, integrated way.
For sure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Anne. Bob.
Thank you, Basil, and thank you, Commissioner, for you and the panel. You've obviously put a tremendous amount of work into this, covered a lot of material. I have two questions, comments, but questions. First, in one of your first slides, you pointed out that under the CLCPA accounting, that transportation currently is making up 29% of our greenhouse gas emissions. And then you went on and said that if we follow the guidance that your panel's come up with, then by 2030, we'll have cut those emissions by 16% compared to 1990. And of course, the economy-wide, we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030, not by 16%. And similarly, by 2050, you say that your recommendations will lead to a 77% cut. And of course, we need 85% economy-wide. With transportation making up so much of our greenhouse gas emissions, and I do understand the challenges of reducing them, but I feel challenges in some of the other sectors are even greater. And so my question to you is, you know, is your panel considering other mechanisms, other approaches to more aggressively reduce these? That would be my first question. The second question, Dennis noted the value of the advanced materials you sent out. I too appreciate having those, and I took a close look over the weekend. It's very, very helpful. One detail under the clean fuel standards on your slide number 41 you sent out before, it's noted that some biofuels would not generate credits under the CLCPA accounting, and I think that's exactly right. And I'm wondering what the panel and your staff are doing to consider what really makes sense and what does not make sense in terms of biofuels and the clean fuel standards under our New York CLCPA. To be honest, I can see a very, very modest role for biofuels, but I'm skeptical that we want to go very far that way. And I don't want to make sure that we, as a council, have very, very clear guidance to you all on that. So, but again, thank you.
Ray Trish, you're muted.
Thank you. So to your first question, Bob, I think that the advisory panel really looked at recommending strategies that are really going to significantly contribute to achieving the larger CLCPA goals, and that level of ambition specifically for transportation is going to be, it will really help inform the integration analysis that's going to take place, and we hope that it'll be addressed through the scoping plan that's developed. But that said, we really need to look at, you know, the self-help mechanisms that are assumed in our recommendations. And the advisory panel, I think, really understands that to fully implement the requirements of the larger CLCPA, you know, we really need to look both at the complementary strategies nationally as well as regionally, but and also recognize that technology is going to advance over the course of this period, and that as we do that, we need to adjust accordingly. So whether that's through investments, additional investments, et cetera, we really need to look at how we can further evolve. And that larger integration analysis, I think, and the scoping plan will help provide room and flexibility for us to do that.
And Commissioner Dominguez, it's Jared Snyder. If I could just jump in on the other question about the low carbon fuels. You know, Bob, I think that's something that you know, will be addressed in part in the integration analysis of, you know, evaluating, you know, what fuels are available, what is the capacity, and what are the best uses. You know, we certainly see, you know, a role for technology or for fuels like, you know, biodiesel and renewable diesel that would achieve some level of greenhouse gas reduction under our accounting strategy, in part because they do not involve imported fossil fuels. A fuel like renewable gas, biogas, that might be, you know, a bit more difficult, and will, you know, that will need to be evaluated, you know, in the integration analysis, you know, what carbon benefits are achieved and what is the best use of it. And if I could just weigh in also on the emission reduction piece, one thing you see at the end there, you know, with that 77% reduction, big part of the rest is aviation fuels. And, you know, as Commissioner Dominguez said, there will be, you know, technology development. We're going to need, you know, technology development to advance in that area of aviation fuels to address that nut, because, you know, at this point, we don't have the silver bullet for it. It may be an area for, you know, lower carbon fuels currently existing or in development.
But I will say it was very purposeful to make sure that we had representation from the airlines and the aviation industry on our transportation advisory panel. So I think it's been a robust discussion that we look to continue with the members of our advisory panel.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Jared, for that extra extra detail. I'm glad that you're paying attention to the details of the biofuels. And I also greatly appreciate that the panel actually put some quantitative numbers into here. And I understand totally that 2050 is a long way out and air transportation is going to be a challenge, but I would like to see us be more aggressive in addressing the 2030 target of 40% reduction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob, thanks. Donna.
Good morning. Thank you, Basil. Thank you, Commissioner, for the really detailed presentation. I really have two questions, and one is just, and maybe it speaks to the integration process, but how do we look at these policy recommendations for transportation that they're going to require a lot of infrastructure build out, they're going to require, you know, customer behavior changes through the incentives that you put in place. And so the timing of the demand growth that results from these recommendations, and how does that then get matched to the timing of the supply growth on the power gen side and the decarbonization of the power gen? And then what happens? I guess I'm struggling with, you know, how do we reconcile, you know, what if the build out doesn't happen quickly enough on the demand side? How do we then adjust the policies, or do we adjust the policy? So that's one kind of general high level question. How does it get matched to the supply side, you know, greening of the grid? And then my other question, it might be more for the co-chairs, I'm not sure. You know, there's so many recommendations. This is only the first panel today. How do we know which of these advance into the integration model? And how do we, you know, do we get more involvement in understanding these in greater depth? So that's kind of the scope of my questions. Thank you.
I keep putting myself on mute to avoid any reverberation, but the question that you asked is a global question, right? The first question that you asked with regard to infrastructure and timing and integration, and that is really a function of what we're looking at in the integration analysis to make sure that all of the work groups and all of the work that they're undertaking, whether that's on the power gen side, the infrastructure piece, electrification, everything, and the timing of all of that is included in it. And I say that because it really is, it, you know, we need to have that holistic approach and that view to understand how this is sequenced out, the timing, the level of investment, et cetera. And that really, and that goes for the grid as well. So that's how we're looking at it. That's why this integration analysis and the scoping plan as our next steps are so critical. And I don't say that to punt, but it does lead directly into the second series of questions. And that is really something that the CAC, that we all need to take on. But I will allow that for Basil and Doreen to potentially further address that. But, you know, that's basically how we're looking at doing it, making sure that we're coordinated.
Yes, with respect to sort of what we do next, Donna, I think one thing that I would be happy to share in the not too distant future would be a summary of these recommendations in some aggregated form that will allow all of us to sort of take stock of this together, each panel having completed its presentations today, allows us now to look at this holistically. And you're right, some recommendations, I would say, lend themselves well to modeling, and other recommendations lend themselves well to other forms of thought as to sort of how we take up the issue together. So essentially, that's what we are now turning to do. I would be glad to share that in an aggregated form with the members. And obviously, we can certainly use part of our next meeting in June to talk about how we're thinking about it together as well.
Okay. Anne, you have your hand up still. That's a remnant. I think Gavin is up, though.
Yeah, it's not a remnant, but I don't think it's my turn.
Okay, Gavin.
Thank you. Thanks, Commissioner. Couple comments first, and I have a couple questions. Commissioner Dominguez, I appreciate the commitment to market-based outcomes. I think that that's a really nice signal from the working group. And I also just want to compliment you and Jared's comments about new technologies and development of hydrogen and other technologies to help move the law forward in this area. So kudos to you on that. My question is sort of builds upon Donna's about infrastructure. There's a lot of requirements in the energy world about transmission and distribution requirements to make sure we have a reliable grid. What type of work went in the working group to ensure that we have a transmission and distribution system that's going to be able to deal with this? And two, what kind of thought have we given to how do you manage the grid with all this new demand? Because it's a different type of demand and a different type of system. So the questions are sort of similar, but they're different. And I just wanted to see what the effort went in by the group on those questions.
So I'll start, and then I'm gonna punt to Doreen, because I think part of it is that we really need to one of the groups you're going to be hearing from is the power generation panel and how that all comes together. So the question is very important, Gavin, and how do we actually make sure that the grid is ready for all of this? We looked at it as a very holistic. We were looking at it primarily from a transportation infrastructure perspective, recognizing that we did a lot of coordination with the power gen panel and others to really make sure that we've got that level of coordination. So, and I'll turn it briefly over, Ron, if there's anything more you want to say on this, and then maybe Doreen.
Commissioner Dominguez, maybe I'll mention that the panel met with the power generation panel, met with the utility group to discuss some of these issues that Gavin identified, including, policies that would shift demand to periods, demand for charging, for example, to periods where there may be excess capacity available on the grid. And so, a very important piece of the electrification strategies is exploring rate design that stimulates that type of charging behavior. But I think as Commissioner Dominguez said, we'll hear from power generation at the end of the day, and then that's going to be a critical part of the integration analysis is, aligning the recommendations of all of these panels.
Yeah, and the other piece of work that is ongoing, Gavin, which I know you're well aware of, is the power grid study that was issued earlier this year by the Department of Public Service with support from NYSERDA. That really did look, but needs to continue to evolve the effort, both with respect to the distribution and the bulk system around the levels of electrification that we are seeing come forth through these panels and beyond. So I think that's an analytic piece of work, and both an analytic piece of work as well as a progress policy and actual investment that is ongoing now. So that's the piece that I would add.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping you would talk about is the ongoing study. So thank you, Dory.
Like we have Commissioner Sagos is not on camera, so I wonder if he got pulled away. Maybe we could just go to Peter Iwanowicz. I see his hand is raised.
Maybe Basil is hydrating like I was.
Yes. That's great. Peter?
Great. Thanks. Good morning, everybody. Commissioner Dominguez, thanks for your presentation. And again, thanks to everybody that was part of the panel for putting together the written materials, which are very comprehensive. I echo Bob and Dennis's comments earlier. I've got a couple of comments and then a series of questions. They're going to be clarifying ones, so I'll try to go through them slowly because there's a number. I'll ask them first and maybe have some interaction. So my first overarching comment is, I don't know how we as a Climate Action Council can actually put forward a draft scoping plan that doesn't contemplate the complete elimination of the transportation sector emissions. I want to uplift a comment that Bob Howarth had made a while ago. If this is an area that probably is going to be a heck of a lot easier, even though challenging, than other sectors like existing building stock, all the furnaces we have in people's homes. When I think of that challenge, I think of, you know, the motor vehicle sector. So with that, in the transportation sector, I know that I think Jared mentioned aviation, which I'm highly skeptical that we wouldn't be preempted on dealing with biofuels in the aviation sector by FAA. But what else isn't covered in that 23% shortfall if we were assuming that we have to zero out transportation sector emissions if we have any hope of achieving our overall? So that's my first one. What's not there? And then a side clarification. Did I hear you say that the transportation panel is recommending that all farm vehicles and equipment get zeroed out? Because that was not a recommendation made by the agricultural panel at our meeting in April. And I'm happy to hear that because I think that was a glaring omission. But I just wanted to not put words in your mouth. So transportation is what's in the 23% that's not covered by 2050? And then the farm is the subset. A follow-up question on transportation. In 2013, New York State signed a multi-state MOU to achieve a significant increase in electric vehicles hitting our street. I think it's 800,000, 850,000 is roughly New York State's proportion of that multi-state MOU. Is that still in existence? And where are we with that? Or what lessons have been learned that the panel sort of looked at? Because if we'd been working for the last 9 years, I think we'd be a little bit further along towards that 850 number by 2025. So that's another question. Transit-oriented development, love it. I think it's a really smart approach. I really enjoyed your comments, especially the one where you said, when you see it, you know what it is. Firmly believe that. My question is actually just sort of logistically, outside of the consultation with the land use and local government panel itself, did the transportation panel directly consult with local governments on the whole issue of transit-oriented development? And if so, which local governments did you reach out specifically to, independent of any consult with land use and local government? Not to sound like a broken record, but we all know that that panel does not have any direct representation from local governments on it. Low carbon fuels and TCI, you dropped into your comments related to both this whole concept of carbon neutrality. And I'm very concerned about that whole concept in the transportation sector because having advocated for a number of years and been intimately involved with the creation of the CLCPA and the law, I don't see how carbon neutrality fits into the transportation scheme, to be honest, where you could offset emissions somewhere else to cover emissions that were happening elsewhere. So my concern about low carbon fuels and TCI is, and actually the written materials, you said something to the effect of the materials have this statement, that things like TCI do not necessarily achieve emissions reductions in specific communities. I'll just posit for someone that's worked in this space for almost 30 years that these specific communities typically are ones that are predominantly where Black and Brown people live. And so I want to hear a little bit more of the conversation that you had at the transportation panel around these issues, because I'm increasingly concerned as today went on, and I've heard discussions elsewhere that we're looking at the CLCPA recommendations on how much money gets spent in these communities. But I don't see where we're looking at the actual emission reductions. CLCPA requires us to prioritize emissions reductions, not just the spending of the benefits. That's sacrosanct and then really should be upheld. But it's also emissions reductions. So these trading schemes that people are putting forward, low carbon fuel standards, TCI, to me, it almost has a sense of other cap and trade programs where you have almost like trickle down environmental justice. And I think often if the emissions reductions aren't prioritized there and we're just assuming that, well, if we spend some money somewhere else, they'll get benefits, that's really not the right way to evaluate these types of schemes under the CLCPA. So I'm curious about your reaction to that. two other points. Sorry, I had a lot on this sector, but it's really important. The integration, and I've raised this one in an earlier presentation earlier this year. To what extent are we looking at motor vehicles as energy storage devices, the whole concept of vehicle to grid? I really am continue to be fluxum that the pathway analysis assumes we're going to have more motor vehicles in 2050 than we have today, which I think will probably be a failure on our part to achieve the reductions under the CLCPA. But there's going to be millions of vehicles on our roads in 2050. If they're battery powered, they will be energy storage devices. But I'm not seeing a lot of conversation in the materials about the role that motor vehicles will play in grid surety and sort of, you know, dealing with the issues that Donna DeCarol has sort of raised earlier with harmonization with the power sector. And then finally, just a last comment. I think I'm really happy to see the level of discussion about market-based and funding mechanisms. I think there were some shortfalls in earlier presentations to figure out the pay-fors. So I'm really happy that this panel dug into a lot of those issues. And I'll just sort of throw out there for the participants sort of online and my colleagues at the Climate Action Council that if we're truly looking at how to ensure economy-wide pricing strategies to fund the just transition, I would do what many of us in the environmental community did in 2015, is actually go to those frontline communities who are putting together just transition plans and ask them how they would like to see emissions reductions and the funding strategies go forward. I'll be a spoiler. I think many of those communities that you would go to would say, pass the Climate Community Investment Act. It is, once again, the funding strategy and the spending strategy that is preferred by those who are on the front lines of the climate crisis. It requires the polluters to pay for the emissions that they're belching out. And it also then ensures that the spending happens in those communities with an eye towards exactly what those communities want it spent on. It's not going to be dictated by this council or parties from afar like the TCI conglomerate. It will be really dictated and driven by what the communities have wanted. So just like the CCPA that became the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, the CCIA is again developed by those on the front lines for the front lines to help the front lines. And I would really implore folks to take a look at that legislation that's been introduced by the Senate and the Assembly, because I think it is that across the board thing that harmonizes pricing in the power generation sector, pricing in the transportation sector, even in the agricultural sector. So I'll pause there and look forward to your answers on the questions I raised.
This is Maureen. I just want to interject for a second on a time check. We have just a little over 15 minutes left.
Commissioner Dominguez, you may be on mute.
I was. Sorry about that. Okay, so Peter, I'm not sure that I got all of the questions, but I'm happy to circle back make sure that we indeed address a number of your questions and comments. I want to start actually, and Jared, if you could, we have great support here from a number of folks that have worked directly with the Transportation Advisory Panel, Jared and Adam and Ron amongst them. So Jared, maybe if you wouldn't mind taking on the question with regard to the low carbon fuel standard, maybe you can start there.
Okay, so Peter, I mean, you sort of raised the low carbon fuel standard and TCI, I think, at sort of the same time. On the low carbon fuel standard, we don't see it as necessarily neutrality. We see it as reducing emissions in the state. Through these strategies, and so under the the COCPA, for example, we need to consider the upstream emissions associated with fossil fuels. Anything that moves away from fossil fuels reduces those upstream emissions and gets us emission reductions towards the emission reduction goal. In addition, if we're using, you know, biofuels produced from waste in New York, that maybe reduces waste emissions, which are direct emission reductions in New York State. So those are just a couple of examples of how, you know, low carbon fuels achieve reductions, as well as the Low Carbon Fuel Standard also supports electrification. And, you know, our grid will be zero carbon by 2040. So that's direct emission reductions as well. I'd like to give an example about, you know, TCI and emission reductions in communities. Yes, a cap and invest program does not require emission reductions in any particular location. But the investments of the proceeds can be targeted to achieve emission reductions in locations. So, you know, think about we're recommending a mandate that manufacturers sell roughly 30% electric trucks by 2030. How do we get those trucks deployed in disadvantaged communities where they provide the greatest benefits? And that can be, you know, part of the investment of proceeds from a TCI program, that those could be targeted so that those trucks are being deployed in the communities where they provide the greatest emission reduction benefits and the greatest public health benefits. Now, TCI is not the only funding mechanism, as you recognize. There are other mechanisms that the panel identified. And I guess while I have I can touch on your first couple questions as well about what else is in that you know, 23% remaining besides aviation. I mean, aviation is certainly a big part of it. One part of it is there will still be some diesel emissions by 2050, as you saw in that one chart that we showed, and that's because we won't be electrifying all new truck sales until 2045, which means trucks sold until 2045 that run on diesel will still be on the road at that time. Unless we have, you know, the incentive programs that get them off the road, you know, some kind of cash for clunkers for trucks or something along those lines. And then I think off-road may be part of it as well. The panel did not specifically address farming emissions in response to your question there, but recognized the need to electrify off-road equipment. It really depends on, you know, I think there's different challenges in different sort of subsectors, farming versus construction versus port equipment, you know, all have different challenges, and we recognize the need toward moving towards electrification of all of those subsectors, but they may have different policies and different schedules. So
thank you, Jared.
Let me end there, yeah.
Thank you very much. I want to underscore what Jared said about farming equipment and the other subcategories. We did not make a specific recommendation, but rather recognize the goal towards electrification. The other question that you asked specifically, Peter, was around the local governments and smart growth recommendations. We did have a series of engagements with the local land use and local government advisory panel, as well as expert roundtable discussions with various members. And so I think the takeaway from all of that is really understanding that local governments in New York and really across the nation, I think, are really looking at smart growth and transit and transportation-oriented development as really a smart business model. And we've seen that consistently. I think the, you know, people are moving back into communities that are more walkable and bikeable and accessible by public transportation across the board. And where we see that development and encourage it through some of these strategic investments is really where we can have significant impact. So that's really the way that we've looked at local government, and we'll continue to do that level of outreach and engagement as we move forward. So I'm not sure we covered everything, but I think that was a good swath.
You did cover most, but there was one that I was hoping to get a little bit more clarity on. Is this multi-state MOU from 2013, where we are there, what was looked at, the benefits, is it still in force? Are we still anticipating to hit 850,000 vehicles in 3.5 years' time?
So maybe I can touch on that. So Peter, that 850,000 number was based on the amount of vehicles that would need to be sold to meet the California standards, which we adopted. So the zero emission vehicle mandate that we have in place. The way that is structured, fewer electric vehicles now need to be sold to meet that mandate because the vehicles get more credits because they have greater distance. They can, you know, go 250 miles on a charge. So they're earning, you know, more credits, and fewer would have to be sold. That MOU also has a pretty steep curve starting around now of picking up. We have been on pace really through 2018, 2019. We ran into, you know, a little bit of an obstacle with the Trump administration lifting, you know, the authority to enforce the waiver, but sales continued to increase in New York of electric vehicles due to our incentive programs and our build out of charging infrastructure. So I think we're making really good progress. And, you know, this is an area where, you know, we're working with other states and California on, you know, making sure the manufacturers, you know, abide by the standards that we put into place, and then thinking about what's the next stage in the zero emission vehicle mandate so we can meet that goal of 100% by 2035.
Okay. The only other thing I raised was the vehicle to grid question. Maybe that will come up during the power generation panel, I guess. It doesn't sound like there was too much to report here.
Well, we talked about it and recognized in particular school buses as being a very, you know, a great opportunity for vehicle to grid because of the downtime, but not the only use. And as you know, more and more electric vehicles get on the road, you know, that there may be opportunities to provide power back to the grid during the day, for example, when they're parked at work. And so there's many opportunities to continue to explore there, and we recognize that as an opportunity.
Thanks.
Okay. And we have a couple minutes left.
Sure. My question was stimulated by something Donna said about how we're going to decide which of these recommendations go forward. And Commissioner, I think you said I wrote down, it was around slide 15, that all these recommendations may in fact fall short based on the pathways report, and we might have to go back and reevaluate. So I wanted to see if I understood that correctly, but my interpretation of that is we're considering putting forth all of these recommendations in order to get where we want to go, and thus far the analysis would be close to this being enough, if you interpret it that way. And I do think it's important to know if they go together based on some of the things Peter said. We need not only the requirements to reduce emissions, but to make sure the emissions are reduced in the places we want, and we also need the money to implement it. And he pointed out that the all the funding mechanisms, TCI, low carbon fuel standard, and CCIA, do not require reductions in particular locations. We need the rules for that, the regs, the phase out of fossil fuel vehicles. So did I interpret that right, that you sort of expressed a little bit concern that all of these recommendations together, you think is going to get based on pathways, maybe not? It was an early slide.
So it's an acknowledgement of really the fact that, you know, this is what we're taking on. It's the holistic measures that I put forward in the presentation, recognizing that as we move towards these goals, not only will technology advance, but there will be other things that we need to consider in addition to help adjust those greenhouse goals, greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. So this is one part of a larger strategy, and I think we just have to keep, as a CAC, keep in mind that, you know, what we have on the table right now is very comprehensive, and we need to continually be open to additional technology advancements and technology and other things that can help us further achieve our goals. So that's what it was really a nod to.
Okay, Dr. Shepson and then Raya. And that should close us out.
Okay, I'm glad we have completely run out of time. I'm impressed by the comprehensive character of this report. Yeah, you know, part of it is investment in public transportation, which is in part on a collision course with extreme events related to climate change. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the extent to which the panel considered specific investments in areas where there is vulnerability, like we saw in New York City during Sandy. And those sorts of problems are going to get much worse in the next three decades. So can you comment on building efforts to build climate resilient public transportation infrastructure?
So, Paul, this was a huge element of what we actually did talk about, in particular, not just for transit, but writ large, and the resiliency factor that we need to build into our transportation standards, our floodplain standards, everything that we've got that help really look at the larger sustainability and resiliency factors for infrastructure. And one of the things that we benefited from was having Pori from the MTA, who's in charge of environment, on the panel. And she provided, in fact, a very specific presentation on the resiliency measures that the MTA in particular has learned, the takeaways, what they've done, how they've approached extreme weather events, and how that's getting translated across the entire system. And as a result of that, how we can take those lessons learned and apply them for all of transportation, but specifically for transit. So what you see here in our recommendations, one, reflects that input, but two, is also the level of coordination that we're undertaking with our other work groups here that are looking specifically at resiliency and sustainability.
I assume that presentation you're referring to is available somewhere.
I don't know, but we'll make sure that we can provide it. I think it's material that FTA has published publicly, so I'm happy to share it with you.
Thanks.
Okay, Raya, you have the last word.
All right. And very briefly, thank you so much, Paul, for uplifting the resilience piece. And yes, I think as a council, looking at that in a comprehensive manner is going to be big. And I just wanted to take the opportunity again to double down on this idea of accountability and metrics. I do think that the individual panel should be working on it, but certainly as a council, we should be focused on it. How can we make sure that we prioritize emissions reductions in disadvantaged communities, you know, as we are achieving our emissions reductions goals in the context of these particular programs? I say it, I've got a lot of experience working with utilities in California and Illinois to develop different types of metrics. Definitely look forward to doubling down on that work here. Thank you very much. And thank you so much. Really comprehensive presentation.
Thank you, Raya. We'll definitely take it to heart.
Okay. Great conversation. Obviously, a short conversation, much more to deliberate upon, but I thank you, Marie-Thérèse. Good job moving the panel forward. Now we'll turn the discussion to Sarah Crowell, Land Use and Local Government. Sarah, please take us away.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I just want to say I am not sitting in the dark. I don't know what's the deal with my camera, so I apologize that I look like a shadow, but I assure you I can see, and you can see the screen, so that's the most important thing. But I want to thank you all for the opportunity to share the recommendations of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel with the council today. I'm not sure if it was purposeful or it's just serendipitous scheduling, but it's appropriate that we follow transportation. I think you'll see that there is a lot of overlap, and the two panels really build on each other. So it's interesting timing. It's good timing. So can I have the next slide, please? Great. So I want to start by acknowledging the commitment of all of the members of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel over the past months. This panel was made up of a group of dedicated practitioners and area experts in land use and local governance throughout our state, and they worked exceptionally hard to develop and come to agreement on the recommendations I'm going to present to you today. I also want to take just a moment to thank the staff working group led by Paul Beyer of the Department of State, who did double duty with our panel and transportation, and also Brad Tito of NYSERDA, who worked alongside the panel members throughout the process and shepherded a really tremendously talented and dedicated group of government staff. Can I have the next slide, please? So our panel members, as I said, they brought to the table significant background and experience working for and alongside local government. In fact, I myself came from local government. I served as the planning director of two different communities prior to joining the Department of State. So we all knew well sort of the challenges that local government is facing in this effort. But New York State is exceptionally large and diverse. There are 62 counties, 62 cities, 900 towns, and over 500 villages. So we recognized right away as a panel, and I think it was actually also the members of this council also pointed out, there's a need to bring more voices to the table to ensure that our recommendations really reflect and respond to the needs and interests of the whole state to the largest extent possible. The next slide, please. So in order to sort of address this, we convened representatives from local governments from all 10 regions of the state at two public roundtables, as well as a series of smaller conversations throughout the process to both solicit ideas and to receive feedback. These convenings turned out to be a particularly valuable part of our process. And we came to view the members of the roundtable as partners, generously providing thoughtful and helpful input at key points, both formally and informally, and serving as sounding boards for ideas and even connecting us with other stakeholders and individuals who might be able to help inform our recommendations. To broaden our reach even further, we also conducted a stakeholder input survey to gather feedback from our panel member networks, as well as a greater variety of local representatives. And finally, we met with the New York State Association of Counties, the County Planners Association, and others to add those perspectives to our work. All of this work with local government and other partners was exceedingly valuable. And in fact, many of the recommendations I'll talk about today are derived from effective policies and programs that local governments have instituted throughout the state. We find a lot of local leaders that we can emulate sort of across the state. Next slide, please. So just in summary, overall, we work toward a process that has been as inclusive and open as possible. In total, our formal meeting schedule included 8 full panel meetings, in addition to 2 local government roundtable events that I just talked about. Those were all open to the public. And during those, we received public input through the chat function during all of those meetings. And we also accepted public input during a dedicated public engagement session. Additionally, we received public input, which came in through our dedicated email account. We received over 100 written comments throughout the process, and they're still coming in. In addition, recognizing that local government has a role that transcends sectoral boundaries and that our recommendations must provide some of the scaffolding needed to realize the goals of other panels, we collaborated closely with the other advisory panels, both through multi-panel meetings and staff working group consultations. In particular, we spent a lot of time with agriculture and forestry, with transportation, energy efficiency and housing, and power generation. We worked on working out challenging issues related to the role of local governments across all those sectors and coming up with strategies to address our ambitious goals that we will work, that will work at the local level. And next slide, please. So just quickly, I just want to talk about how we tackled our issues. To really address the myriad issues that our panel had in front of us, we broke into four subgroups. Land use, which is based largely on the principle of smart growth that all our agencies support. Clean energy, where we focus really on local government-based energy systems and development of renewable energy. Carbon sequestration, which was based largely on strategic land and natural resource conservation, and adaptation and resilience. Now that group, those recommendations will be presented at the next meeting, so we won't be really diving into that today. But these four subgroups lent organization to our approach. They gave us a framework within which we worked, but in practice, there's really no clear line dividing these four categories. They're all based in land use decisions and local government authority, particularly in a state that supports distributed community-based energy. Our energy systems are in our backyard, sometimes literally. And with that in mind, our subgroups often overlapped, and many of our members participated in more than one, and some participated in all four. Not honestly sure how they made the time. And again, I'll just reiterate, they were incredibly generous with their time, our panel members. So both as a full panel and subgroup working sessions, our panel began by defining our scope and organizing our ideas into coherent buckets. We identified and consolidated themes and priorities. We translated those themes into simple and actionable strategies. And finally, through an iterative process, we translated our strategies into achievable recommendations for detailed multi-level review and readied them for the integration analysis and consideration by the Climate Action Council. Can I have the next slide, please? So as our panel developed our strategies and recommendations, there were several key themes emerged listed here on this slide. First, it was supporting local and regional initiatives to promote efficient land use and smart growth that reduces VMTs. Secondly, maximizing the carbon sequestration potential of both developed and undeveloped land. Third, facilitating responsible development and adoption of clean energy sources and renewable energy. Fourth, providing communities the necessary tools and resources to lead on climate and to fully participate as partners in attaining our ambitious statewide CLCPA goals. And finally, sort of across all of our strategies was addressing environmental justice and just transition, and ensuring commitments to disadvantaged and under-resourced communities, both urban and rural, across all strategies. We are mindful of the fact that in reforming land use policies, we are overcoming decades of exclusionary zoning, discriminatory lending practices, and the often devastating effects of urban renewal on communities of color in particular. And our panel's recommendations really were made reflective of that throughout all of the recommendations. May I have the next slide, please? So now I just want to delve into some of the areas that I outlined before. Smart growth is central, as I said, to across all of our recommendations. As Commissioner Dominguez noted, smart growth promotes compact, mixed use, walkable municipal centers of activity at all levels, from cities to towns to rural villages and hamlets, is smart because it balances the four E's on which its core principles are based: equity, environment, economy, and energy in this context. We're compelled both morally and statutorily to ensure that we achieve smart growth in its most complete and pure forms through all our land use and local government recommendations, which means equity is ubiquitous. We do have models on which to build. The Brownfield Opportunity Area Program, for example, is a clear manifestation of what we strive for when we talk about smart growth. Indeed, the BOA program is a child of the environmental justice community. So to achieve smart growth, we focused on strengthening the role of regional and county-based land use planning to guide, inform, and incentivize smart, equitable, sustainable land use decisions on the municipal level. For example, there's an opportunity to identify priority development and conservation areas at the regional level and to use a variety of tools to incentivize and direct development to those areas intended for further development and encourage conservation of the areas outside of those areas, outside the areas designated for development. On this slide, you can see a couple of examples of this. On the left is Genesee County. This is an image from their smart growth plan, which shows areas where water lines can be extended. Water lines cannot be extended outside of these designated growth areas, which are shown in blue. On the right is Tompkins County. That's a little tiny slide. I'm not sure if you can see it, but in Tompkins County, they took a similar approach by designating natural resource areas where growth is not preferred, and by informally trying to preserve those areas while directing development to what they call development focus areas. May I have the next slide, please? Now you're going to see some of the real overlap between this panel and the transportation panel. We've focused specifically on transit-oriented development in the land use and local government panel. TOD is because it's a critical element of smart growth, and it was the focus of a number of key recommendations. TOD is defined as walkable, bikeable, compact, mixed-use, mixed-income development within a half-mile radius of a rail station or bus rapid transit service. TOD is recognized as one of the most energy efficient and climate friendly forms of land use and development in the 2015 State Energy Plan because it reduces vehicle use and dependence and thus transportation-based greenhouse gas emissions. It also offers clean and accessible mobility options such as walking, biking, and transit. Aside from addressing energy and climate change, TOD also offers a tremendous opportunity for New York State to promote socioeconomic equity and environmental justice by embracing affordable and mixed income housing near transit through inclusionary zoning and incentives, by providing opportunities for greater outdoor physical activity and social interaction, which yield both physical and mental health benefits, by reducing particulate air pollution from vehicle emissions, and by relieving the disproportionate amount of time and money that low-income households must devote to travel and commuting. It's important to note that TOD is not just about rail, nor is it confined just to downstate or just to urban areas. Through other means of public transit, such as bus rapid transit and emerging first mile, last mile options, TOD also is relevant in more rural areas and can and should be considered in town and village centers and hamlets throughout the state. Next slide, please. So to support communities to achieve smart growth development patterns in TOD, our panel considered two distinct but interconnected approaches. First, direct planning assistance in the form of planning grants, technical assistance, and capacity building. And second, providing the tools and resources necessary for localities to independently make the best and most informed decisions about where to grow, how to grow, and where not to grow. We won't be able to reach our land use greenhouse gas emissions goals unless we proliferate smart growth and planning zoning. But the reality is that many municipalities really need our help at the state level. They just don't have the staff, resources, time, and or expertise to do it independently. That's where the state can help, by empowering, not mandating, communities to plan, zone, and develop in a smart, sustainable, and equitable way. Next slide, please. So alignment of state funding resources from economic development to infrastructure to housing and everything in between that influences land use outcomes is also key. Municipalities and community-based organizations must see that the state is serious about smart growth and is putting money behind its policies and recommendations. In other words, smart growth must be ubiquitous in the consolidated funding application and all funding sources so that firstly, we're not enabling sprawl. And secondly, that we are directly enabling and supporting smart growth. Please. While the panel's specific strategies and the panel's specific strategies and recommendations to promote smart growth are lengthy and detailed, I want to highlight some of the key strategies our panel proposed here listed on this slide. Firstly, to provide grants and technical assistance for countywide smart growth plans and for municipal comprehensive plans and zoning that are consistent with smart growth principles. Second, to develop criteria and incentivize countywide smart growth comprehensive plans that adhere to the clear state goals and outcomes. And then also to enable designation of these priority development areas and priority conservation areas at the county and at the regional levels, if appropriate. One of our key recommendations is also to strengthen the Smart Growth Infrastructure Act to better align state funding priorities with smart growth principles. also to align state funding priorities to prioritize smart growth, equity, and sustainability in all relevant state funding, including new infrastructure spending, and to develop guidance documents, model local laws, templates, and other resources to simplify and streamline preparation of comprehensive plans and land use regulations that support smart growth principles, and to really help local government be partners in this effort with the state. And finally, to explore other options to promote transit-oriented development. Now, can I have the next slide, please? Great. Okay, now we get to carbon sequestration. Smart growth land use policies that guide development to more concentrated areas and target other areas for conservation provide the opportunity also to maximize natural carbon sequestration potential in those areas. Forested lands play the most significant role in carbon sequestration and storage, an area that Commissioner Ball addressed comprehensively when he presented the recommendations of the Agriculture and Forestry Land Use Panel at the last meeting. As I've noted, our panel really worked closely with others. So we did work, the recommendations of that panel really were sort of integrated into ours. And we also, our panel's recommendations really focus on allowing for preservation of natural areas that complements the work of the Ag and Forestry panel as well as others. And we were informed by those recommendations. The area where I'm gonna focus today is wetlands and sort of the Valley of Wetlands and other natural areas. They add to our collective strategies to offset greenhouse gas emissions. Protect and restoration of these ecosystems are compatible with smart growth, climate adaptation, and resilience recommendations set forth that are also set forth by some of the other panels. So the Land Use and Local Government panel's recommendations are really intended, as I said, to complement and build on the work of the other panels, include increasing carbon sequestration and storage capacity in freshwater wetlands, coastal and tidal wetlands, submerged aquatic vegetation, coastal habitat, and other natural areas. And the next slide, please. To build on the capacity of decision makers to contribute to carbon sequestration efforts, the panel recommended focusing on mapping, research, planning, and technical assistance. Next slide, please. So let me get right into some of the key carbon sequestration strategies that were included in our panel's suite of recommendations. These include considering opportunities to improve and expand regulations, as well as improve implementation of regulatory programs to ensure carbon sequestration and storage potential of wetland systems are not lost. We also proposed increasing investment in protection, restoration, and monitoring to maximize carbon sequestration potential of freshwater wetlands and blue carbon through measures such as the Environmental Bond Act and the New York State Conservation Partnership Program. We also recommend updating maps of wetlands and coastal habitats and other natural areas using the best available technology with recurring updates. Really good information is critical for decision makers at all levels to plan appropriately and efficiently to ensure maximum carbon sequestration. An important aspect of this particular recommendation is ensuring that maps and tools are publicly accessible and useful to the public. The recommended statewide conservation framework is an example of this. It would use current maps and data sets to inform conservation decision making and provide a shared vision for prioritizing state funding, land protection, and technical assistance programs. To complement good data, our panel also recommends providing assistance to county and local governments to create land use policies and land conservation programs. And we recommend helping landowners by developing incentives and management practices, both with the aim to conserve and restore wetlands and natural areas. We also recommend improving our collective understanding of carbon storage and sequestration in natural systems like wetlands through research, monitoring, and demonstration projects. It's really important to keep this information up to date, and the research is there. There's just a lot of research out there to be done in order to properly understand the value of these types of ecosystems. And finally, we recommended engaging both youth and professionals in conservation service and stewardship to maximize carbon sequestration opportunities and also to support green job career training. May I have the next slide, please? So we've talked about promoting smart growth and effective land use patterns, as well as protecting sort of protecting and preserving carbon sequestration potential. But another key land use decision that our panel considered was the development of renewable and clean energy. Local government plays an essential role both in achieving all the ambitious solar and clean energy goals set forth in the CLCPA. So accordingly, our panel's recommendations call for tools and resources to empower communities to participate fully in the process of planning for and enabling development of renewable energy development, including providing planning support at the local and regional level, development and promotion of model local laws, streamlining permitting, and providing communities with the tools they need to develop local regulations that clearly identify as-of-right installation opportunities for different clean energy technology types, and that they have clear requirements and reasonable processes for installations that are not as-of-right. Next slide, please. In addition to thinking about renewable energy development, our panel also considered strategies to enable communities to transition to clean energy usage, whether sited locally or elsewhere, and to fully benefit from the clean energy economy. Community initiatives can help connect homes, businesses, and community institutions with clean energy products, services, and job opportunities. Community choice aggregation programs, microgrids, district systems, workforce development initiatives, and other community scale campaigns to encourage adoption of new innovative technologies are just some of the options for enabling adoption of clean energy and generating value and savings for communities in an equitable manner. Next slide, please. Some of the specific strategies that our panel is proposing to empower local government to facilitate clean energy development and adoption include providing technical and financial assistance to develop regional clean energy roadmaps that identify low impact locations for solar and wind development that are preferred by the community. This provides a clear path for energy developers to come into a community and work in partnership with that community. Developing a statewide mapping tool that provides communities with information needed to plan for appropriate clean energy siting decisions. As I said previously, I think it's a theme throughout our recommendations, good access to complete and high quality information is critical for local government to participate with the state in achieving our CLCPA goals. Encouraging development of community choice aggregation programs where communities can choose 100% renewable energy as the default supply. This includes potentially empowering counties to be the primary sponsor of a CCA, which will help overcome some of the challenges of really of local capacity at the smallest municipal level. Finally, exploring opportunities to create more robust community host benefits and evaluating options to reduce barriers to development of municipally owned solar installations. And just like to point out that this was an area where we worked very closely with the power generation panel. And I think you'll hear a lot more detail about these types of recommendations of strategies in that presentation. Next slide, please. So throughout our conversations, we heard from local governments that their main limitations are lacking the capacity and resources to effectuate change at the local level. These local governments need simple and achievable programs and funding sources. They need expert technical assistance from trusted sources. They need resources to implement their climate priorities, and they need accessible data, information, and tools to craft informed decisions and policies. To this end, our panel recommends development of tools such as a statewide communities dashboard of community greenhouse gas emissions inventories to promote local climate action planning, to monitor equity considerations, to measure progress, and to ensure data consistency at the county and municipal level. Next slide, please. Local governments also enact the codes, implement projects, and adopt policies and regulate land use. Ensure that they have a far-reaching impact on the community energy picture. The panel heard from many stakeholders about ways the local governments are demonstrating leadership on clean energy and considered how best to encourage local governments to continue to demonstrate this leadership in energy efficiency by developing model above minimum energy conservation construction policies, adopting New York stretch energy code and promoting its adoption at the local level, enhancing code enforcement, including streamlined permitting, third-party inspections and shared enforcement, and facilitating property assessed clean energy or PACE financing. Next slide, please. So some of the, in summary, some of the specific strategies our panel's putting forth for consideration include the following that are shown here on the slide. One is expanding availability of hands-on support and training for municipalities across a range of climate actions, with a focus on increasing support to small, resource-constrained, and underserved communities. Our panel also recommends developing a centralized portal that offers resources and information to assist communities in navigating, accessing, and integrating state programs relative to sustainable community development and clean energy development. Our panel also recommends exploring options to simplify local government enforcement by evolving building codes such as a statewide permitting system, providing communities with a toolkit with templates and guidance to assist local building departments, and providing support for implementation of shared service agreements, third-party inspections for the energy code, and other opportunities to really ease the burden and provide the assistance that local governments need to be able to continue to implement these types of codes. And finally, establish statewide policies that require consistent advancement on building decarbonization by adopting a highly efficient state energy code that's aligned with CLCPA goals as soon as possible, and by establishing energy benchmarking and performance standards for buildings and creating innovative public benefit financing mechanisms. Again, sort of in the theme of our panel worked very closely with other panels. You will hear much more detail on some of those types of activities from the Energy Efficiency and Housing panel. Okay, and may I have the next slide, please? So before closing, I just want to turn briefly to sort of touch on some of the benefits and impacts that that sort of accrue to our panel's recommendations beyond sort of the direct greenhouse gas reduction goals that we've focused on. Co-benefits, there's a number of co-benefits that can be realized through the strategies that I've discussed today. Our recommendations really have the potential not only to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also to benefit disadvantaged under-resourced communities, to improve public health, and to move toward a just transition. I want to point out that disadvantaged communities can really be served with greater access to public transportation through transit-oriented development when designed appropriately and with an eye to sort of mixed income, affordable housing, clean energy investments, and local climate actions that are all focused to benefit disadvantaged communities. Disadvantaged communities can also benefit with greater access to natural areas and healthy environments that are supported by functioning wetlands, coastal areas, and watersheds. Revitalized brownfields in disadvantaged communities is sort of one of the co-benefits that we see coming out of this. By bringing planning resources to under-resourced communities, we can allow for smart, sustainable, equitable projects to replace brownfields and to replace phased out peakers and former power plants. By emphasizing mixed income and affordable housing and the smart growth formula, we would deconcentrate poverty and address displacement and the many forms of gentrification, including green gentrification. We also discussed in our panel new shared equity and ownership opportunities, such as community land trust, deed restricted ownership, and other opportunities to bring community wealth, increased home ownership, and increased displacement and gentrification in disadvantaged communities. We also felt that focusing clean energy investments in disadvantaged communities has the potential to help create jobs, drive investment, and reduce the energy burden by reducing household energy costs. Local programs can be designed to prioritize improvement of energy consuming assets located in disadvantaged communities. And by offering greater participation in local and regional land use decision making, sort of that's kind of a universal benefit that really brings everybody into the decision-making process. Can I have the next slide, please? Great, so I I see I'm almost running out of time, so let me just touch quickly on the public health benefits. Public health was really central to our panel's recommendations by reducing VMT and transportation-based greenhouse gas emissions and including new healthy aquatic ecosystems. We'll improve air and water quality while providing services that benefit people, particularly in disadvantaged communities and communities of color. Co-benefits that may achieve public health benefits include greater physical activity and outdoor recreational access, which yields positive health incomes in communities, more opportunities for social interaction and access to nature, positive mental health outcomes, and providing access to services through walkable, bikeable, and transit-friendly infrastructure. Our recommendations also could help reduce urban heat island effect, which disproportionately impacts disadvantaged communities. And by ensuring that there are fewer local sources of air pollution due to a reduction in VMT and the use and reduction of the use of combustion fuels, that may reduce the incidence of diseases caused by or exacerbated by poor air quality. And finally, healthy and biodiverse wetlands, coastlines, and ecosystems benefit people by providing flood mitigation, recreation, carbon sequestration, clean air and water quality, and moderation of some insect-transmitted diseases. May I have the next slide, please? Okay, and finally, just transition. Our land use strategies really have the potential to play a big part in a just transition. Smart growth and TUD have generated economic development, business attraction, job creation benefits to communities throughout the state. Greater access to transit will help address the effects of job shifts to a clean energy economy, and if they're planned smartly with job opportunities in mind. There are an estimated 164,000 clean energy jobs across New York State, including energy efficiency, renewable energy, grid modernization and storage, renewable fuels, and alternative transportation. Smart growth and land use patterns can help attenuate the spatial mismatch between jobs and housing, particularly in low-income households who spend a disproportionate amount of their time and income commuting, and really give everybody access to these new clean jobs and really jobs in general. I guess I want to just close with a quote from the Smart Growth and Economic Success, the business case, which was a publication of the EPA into 2013. That report stated that locations with housing and transportation options, a mix of uses close together, and a high quality of life can improve environmental outcomes while providing economic advantages for businesses and individuals. All right, next slide, please. Okay, before I completely close out, I want to just once again thank our advisory panel members and the staff at DEC, DOS, and NYSERDA for all their hard work. And I want to thank the council for your time, for your earlier comments, and for your consideration of the strategies our panel is putting forth today. Look forward to your questions. Thanks very much.
Tara, great job. Great job for all of you. Let's start off with Paul.
Thanks very much for that, Sarah. I really enjoyed it. And in particular, I want to comment about the community and statewide dashboard idea. I'm delighted by that idea. I think it's extraordinarily important. You use some, for me, what are magic words, measure progress. I really feel like there is tremendous feedback opportunity. There is a feedback between observations of rates of progress and stimulation of community action, political pressure, and so on. I think it's a really important part of the overall strategy for everyone in New York State to be able to observe in real time where we are and where we're going. So a dashboard that shows where we should be given the Climate Act, where we are according to inventories, but also I'll just comment that it's widely known that inventories are always wrong.
to various extents. And that's particularly true for methane, which might be a third or so of the total greenhouse gas emissions. And it is widely known that it is extraordinarily helpful to have interplay between inventories and observations of actual greenhouse gas emissions at various scales. And I'm wondering if the panel had any conversations about the importance of incorporating observations across the state at various scales of greenhouse gas emissions and incorporating that into the information that would be the foundation of the dashboard.
To sort of update and is that
Chair, can you start over? You're muted.
Oh.
Yeah, you have to start over. I don't think we heard anything.
I'm sorry. Did you hear? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Closer to my computer now. Sorry, I leaned back. I think I moved too far away from the mic. Just to clarify, are you sort of suggesting or asking about the inputs into such a dashboard, and that perhaps there would be, you know, bringing monitoring into this process?
Exactly.
I think, you know, I might ask Brad, if Brad Tito from NYSERDA, if you're on to talk a little bit about that and what I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Paul, that you know, inventories are wrong data. I mean, that, and inventories can be wrong. They can be, it's very hard to sort of local information also to the state level, and there will be, you know, it's an imperfect science, but I believe our panel was interested in sort of trying to make sure that the best possible information was available and fully transparent. But Brad, do you have anything specific on the dashboard that you might add to that?
Well, just to say that the recommendation involves establishing a working group to explore, you know, what are the best methodologies that exist for this kind of accounting. I've seen reports that look at kind of direct monitoring versus estimating, you know, emissions. I think all of that can be considered by the work group. We haven't really dialed in on exactly what the methodology should be, but there are a lot of advancements on this topic of how to prepare these inventories. So this working group would really explore all those things and develop a dashboard that's really user-friendly and accessible to all communities throughout the state.
And one thing that's really helpful in such a dashboard that you in the document indicated would be community-based but statewide is just the opportunity to look for essentially conservation of emissions, that is the sum of all the community emissions would equate to the statewide totals. And there are opportunities for observational sort of evaluation of the inventories at larger than communities at scale, at least for cities. Anyway, I'm just expressing enthusiasm for the impact of a high-quality dashboard.
Great, thank you.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Raya.
So, hello, thank you for that. I also want to express enthusiasm for the dashboard and enthusiasm for process the way, you know, it's clearly, you know, as somebody who, A, thinks that this is probably one of the most important panels, you know, or...
Raya, we lost you for a second there.
She's hydrating.
Thank you, Paul.
Is she actually still on board? Or did we lose her? I don't see her icon here. Well, she'll get back on and we'll bring it right back to her. Bob, can you take up the helm?
Sure, happy to do so. Thank you, Sarah, for
that comprehensive presentation, and thanks to the, all of the panelists. I noted that my friend Ed Marks from Tompkins County was there, so shout out to him for his work on it. I have a question and then a couple of related comments. You presented a lot of different material, and I'm wondering if you are going to recommend particular priorities for us. I mean, it seems to me that we're more likely to do something well if we focus on fewer possibilities as opposed to taking everything on. So my question is, have you thought about that, and do you have a process? But then two comments, one one sort of positive, one very positive, and then one negative. I agree totally with Paul on the dashboard idea. I think it's important that the local communities, our counties and our villages, our towns, have the ability to do greenhouse gas accounting. I also think it's very important to be done in a way that's consistent with what the DEC is bringing on board for the CLCPA as a whole, so that when we add up community by community, we get what the state does. You're going to get a lot of confusion otherwise. Paul's alluded to that, but I think that's a high priority. I will say that I've been trying, well, more than trying, I've been working closely with Tompkins County and the city of Ithaca for the past several years to try and develop accounting systems for them that are consistent with the CLCPA. And they're doing well, they're trying to do so, but they have not been able to find other areas of help. And the software that they use, the software that's commercially available that all governments use, it's not New York specific. It doesn't deal at all with the CLCPA guidance. So Paul mentioned the importance of methane. The software that's available just does not include all of the methane emissions that are associated with our use of fossil fuels, because they don't occur in the community, they occur over the state. CLCPA makes a big deal of that, so we really need to get that in. And I would think that ought to be perhaps the highest priority coming out of here. Let me give you a negative example, though, too. You brought up blue carbon, and I just have to comment. I did my PhD as a coastal oceanographer back in the 1970s. It was on carbon balances of salt marshes and long-term storage. And I continue to work on related issues. We've been funded by the U.S. National Science Foundation for the last 15 years to look at carbon balances and storage in coastal seagrass systems. And these systems really store very, very little carbon in the northeastern context. They cannot really be important in the New York context. So I love seagrasses. I love salt marshes. I spent a lot of my time in them. But I don't think blue carbon in the New York context makes sense. So I would push you as a priority to let's do what really matters and push towards the land use planning, the smart growth planning, and the greenhouse gas accounting. Anyway, the question is, do you have a process for thinking through your priorities?
So that's a good question, and one I might punt on just a little bit, because I don't want to speak for all the panel members. I think that that everything that we presented was important and had champions. By the way, Ed Marks was one of those panel members, to sort of point out who attended every single subgroup meeting, was there for even some of our staff meetings, and was a particularly productive and helpful member of our panel. So we're looking forward to keeping him involved. If he's listening, I want him to hear that and know that we're not letting him go.
I'm not surprised at all to hear that. He's a very talented and thoughtful person.
Very thoughtful. But in terms of let me go backwards for a minute. Blue carbon, I think that is true, and you'll see that we did not have our panel really was focusing on enabling recommendations. We did not do, for a variety of reasons, we didn't calculate the direct carbon, greenhouse gas reduction potential of the recommendations from our panel, because that's not primarily, we're more thinking about enabling other panels to really achieve their goals. And as far as blue carbon goes, I think we recognize that it may not have, the potential, the carbon sequestration potential, that may not be the primary, goal for or the only goal for protecting those ecosystems. But there are very significant, as I'm sure resilience benefits to focusing on coastal, protecting coastal ecosystems and wetlands, and also inland wetlands. So that's part of the reason we focused on that area. But we do recognize, as you said, that all the more research is needed, that the direct carbon sequestration is not to the level that our forested areas are. As far as prioritization, though, while I said everything is important to everything we're recommending is important to our panels, I do think sort of those central goals of providing tools such as a dashboard and such as, and planning assistance, providing increasing one of the models that our state that we have now, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the clean energy coordinators that work through NYSERDA and provide sort of hands-on assistance, it's not just project-based, it's hands-on assistance ongoing to municipalities. Enhancing that kind of support to our municipalities is probably one of our key priorities and was a thread across everything, and providing the tools. And I think, the frustration that Tompkins County is finding and finding the right tools to be able to do these kinds of works is something to do the kind of work that they need to do is are the challenges that we hope to overcome. Not sure if that fully answered your question.
No, that's great. That's okay. Very thoughtful. But let me just briefly respond, particularly to the wetlands and seagrass beds. They definitely should be preserved and protected. They're beautiful systems, and they're incredibly important in the resilience of our coastal systems to climate change. But I think we're best off describing their true value and pushing that true value as opposed to getting disoriented by the blue carbon argument, which in the New York context is just not going to work. I would love to see, to the extent we have research dollars flowing into the community of people who study those, please don't do it for blue carbon. Let's look at other issues in those systems. But thank you.
All right, Bob, thank you. Raya, welcome back. You've got the stage.
Thank you so much. Apparently the internet does not want me to gush about the about the recommendations in this panel. Clearly, from the process, you can hear the type of feedback as someone who's very active in my local municipal, committees, that, the things that we're crying out for and asking for. So I think a lot of what came from here was really, really great. The folks who I heard anyway speaking before to the point about dashboards and data, excellent. One question is, have you thought about the role for our schools, our universities, our local colleges, et cetera, training organizations in getting done some of this research, this data, this planning, which to me is I think one of the most important things that we could be doing is getting that local research done with our local communities and local research institutions. So that was one question. And also, another piece is clearly one of the main things I think that will come out of this plan is exactly what you're talking about, this idea of how do we knit together the policies, the rules and regulations at the state level with the local, local regulations, local laws in a way that empowers, in a way that incentivizes, and also in a way that does not double down on disproportionate burden to disadvantaged communities and creates participatory economies. So identifying that, I think that's a critically important project, something that we can do, without, millions of dollars of funding. And then I guess for the first question is about the research and schools and training organizations. And then the second, have folks thought about, and this is something, in this process, how can we have what the CLCPA requires, which is this environmental justice requirement that we not cause disproportionate burden to disadvantaged communities as we're making those plans?
To your question of schools and universities, et cetera, I think we do, in our more detailed recommendations, we do consider universities and educational institutions as partners, as critical partners in achieving some of these goals. And I can tell you, just on a practical matter, we at Well, Department of State, we pull in, we work very closely with universities on some of our resiliency planning, for example, bringing students in. I think it's the only way. I think we need to bring to bear, I think we all recognize, all of our resources statewide. It's critical not only because that's where the you know, to bring in educational institutions, not only because that's where the sort of the research and innovation may be happening, also to build that next, you know, it's workforce training. It's bringing the next generation of folks into professionals into to make this stuff happen. So I guess my only answer there is yes. That's, I think that they do need to be partners, and it's something our panel certainly considered. You know, as you know, these recommendations, you know, these strategies coming from the panels are in a template format where it's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of information, but there's even more information and a whole nother level that needs to, that we need to get to in order to really, really build out what, you know, how these are going to happen, but how these recommendations will, these strategies will be implemented. But yes, we see educational institutions as key partners. And I think, let me see, your other point was about just how do we, maybe yeah, can you take a refreshment? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, just that the CLCPA requires that we make decisions about these investments and plans in a way that does not cause disproportionate burden to disadvantaged communities. And there was a lot of thoughtfulness there about disadvantaged communities and how we can not, you know, double down on harms that have occurred, but how can we in this particular area build in systems that accountability frameworks that begin to do that. And I get that that's cross-cutting, and I get that we'll do that on a, but this is where the rubber meets the road, you know, in terms of how these policies actually play out on the ground.
Well, I do think that's, as you said, it's a cross-cutting question. It's a very big question. And I don't know if I can fully answer it, but again, you know, I mean, one of the, you know, I could, as an example, one of the ways I think that you know that we can ensure that decisions are made in a way that does reduce impact or disproportionate impact is by engaging the communities themselves. You know, ensuring that the communities themselves are engaged in the process and sort of are empowered to help make the decisions as to where investment goes and what types of land uses, what types of development can occur in their communities and what it looks like. So sort of, I think I mentioned in passing in when I presented the Brownfield Opportunity Area Program as sort of a model of that, and engaging not just the municipality, but also community-based organizations and bringing, you know, bringing the community into the process to help direct, and then giving those plans some sort of, you know, giving those plans the, giving those plans some value and in terms of helping to direct investments. So they're not just plans, they're plans to carry some weight.
Well, I think that's a fantastic start of an answer. Thank you so much. And here in Westchester, we've got so many colleges, training institutions, and so many of them are struggling right now. So it's just such a win-win way, you know, to engage. Thank you so much. What a compelling presentation.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Raya. Dennis.
Please go to me when I'm looking the other way, sorry. So I just want to reflect back on Doreen's statement about the summary of all these recommendations. I think that's a most worthwhile effort that we've got to get. And as I listen to these presentations, I just think the value is going for us as a Climate Action Council is going to be in developing much more holistic non-silo based solutions and recommendations. And I've heard Sarah present in the past. I've heard her present actually to non-climate action, more community based, and I've always been impressed. So I really appreciate her approach to this. I do pick on smart growth a lot because I'm a big fan of smart growth. But most of the models that we're kind of like creating really have to look forward in terms of, you know, how, what is the response to electric demand impact? And if I look at and have been in the middle of interpreting smart growth legislation, it needs to be a discussion, and because I didn't see the Department of Public Service staff as really listed as a other stakeholder in some of the documents that were provided. But there is a disconnect between smart growth legislation and regulatory oversight of utilities. Utilities actually are not really mentioned from a governance point of view under smart growth. And so I think we have a real opportunity of bringing those together. And most of that has to be great input from economic developers, the impact of decarbonization, and what is the speculative impact that that's going to have on our local distribution system. I just think we have this opportunity, and I would just recommend, Sarah, to make sure that we look at those two governance pieces, amongst others. I'm sure there's many others, but specifically, I've always found them not congruent, and I just wanted to mention that. The other thing is we talk about this infill development a lot, and you know, I'm a big fan of, is there ways, whether or not it's through legislation or whether it's through the ability to do this, but consider clean tech and manufacturing investment in terms of incentives based on what is being built within New York to help achieve not only New York's goals, but prepping New York as a manufacturing, clean energy manufacturing base to compete globally. And I just think part of that is smart growth, because infill or backfill within our Rust Belt communities are a real opportunity as long as we can deal with the infrastructure challenges that we have. Because I always hear, you know, what's the cost to achieve our climate action goals? But if we had a deeper economic development slant within the framework of developing, especially these smart goal initiatives, we can almost look at ratepayers, especially our manufacturing ratepayers, not as cost centers, but perhaps as investors for repurposing, as long as they're supporting initiatives like smart growth or climate action goals, et cetera. And I just think that coordination is going to be critical as we go forward. The other piece is that I can't express my appreciation of enough that was mentioned in there about connecting homes, businesses, community institutions with clean energy projects. It's interesting to me that we think they're mutually exclusive, but there's no economic activity unless we solve the challenges of lack of infrastructure, aged infrastructure, or lack of electric capacity. So I'm really appreciative that I believe you guys are now starting to think about this from the context of, where does the definition of resiliency belong? And I believe that it belongs in the hands of the energy consumer. And so thinking about that from whether it's a developer, a residential, disadvantaged communities, all communities, but really thinking about site readiness. As we then think about that, it's really putting technology more at the point of use. And what I've seen in my time is that most of this implementation strategy bumps into building codes that are probably 4 to 8 years behind the goals that are set by the state and that are really required. So what happens is we rely on the interpretation of our fire marshal, our local fire marshal, in terms of whether or not something goes forward or not. And I think we need better understanding and more progressive viewpoints from Department of State and really examining, updating the building code so that they meet what we're trying to achieve here. And that's alignment with what's going on in the regions, the field, the communities, and then what our climate action goals are. Paul mentioned the community dashboard. I think that's a great idea. And I think, Sarah, you mentioned 164,000 clean energy jobs. It would be great to get a breakdown of what those are, because there's a big difference between short-term job creation and then sustainable job creation. So I think we ought to really think about a dashboard that considers an objective like 40% of the spend is to benefit disadvantaged community. Perhaps one of those benefits can be defined as a clean tech job creation, so that we align what we are all shooting for with the actual benefit defined by the community. But I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciated this overview, because I just think we have a great opportunity of making smart growth a real economic development opportunity for us. And that's going to mean that we need more support from Department of State, Empire State Development, and the local regional economic development councils, which I see you mentioned within the body. So just thank you for that.
Great. Thank you, Dennis. And yes, that it is an economic development. I think that was central to what, to our panel's discussions was we talked quite a bit about the sort of relationship with the RIDC process and smart growth planning and the cleaner, greener regional sustainability plans that were completed, I think in 2013, and how those can be better integrated into the RIDC process in order to help, sort of knit everything together. It's a big challenge. You're right. It is unsiloing and bringing, I think that's the next challenge. And I guess the partially the charge to this council, I believe, is knitting all of these recommendations, all these sort of sectoral recommendations together, and sort of bringing strategies, creating strategies that meet multiple goals. It's a real opportunity and a huge challenge. It's something without getting into a long discussion of how we can work with RDCs and how that would work. But we did have discussions with ESD during this process and sort of talked about, some of the ways that those things could tie together. And I think there is a little more detail in the written recommendations and more to come. But I think that, they really are. It's something that's important to consider. And to, you're right, to reach, this economic development does have to reach, in order to reach, every disadvantaged communities as well, I think it's important to think about infill development as job creation, and specifically for clean energy, if that's where we're, now I'm sort of riff on sort of just general, planning and economic development topics that we discussed during the panel, but it is the opportunity. We need to think about the infill and about reusing sites that were, that were in the past. They've created blight in communities. They've created all kinds of public health issues, but maybe they did at least offer jobs in the past. Now it's an opportunity to reuse those and re-envision those as part of this clean economy. And it will require all agencies, all states, and I think all agencies within the state, all players within the state. I think that's sort of what we had in mind when we're talking about expanding the Smart Growth Infrastructure Act, is really thinking about how that act can actually extend beyond the agencies currently listed to sort of more broadly reach toward, to more broadly touch state investment and state decisions overall.
Okay, Dennis, thank you. So we've got Rose Harvey, Ann, Peter, John Howard, and Lunch. Rose.
Thanks. I'm not going on video because I too am having some internet connection issues. I just thank you, Sarah, and I really appreciate it, your presentation. A couple of things. Building on everything that you said and what other panelists have said, but just to kind of take it down to the field and what we could do, but I remember when I was at State Park, we had a couple regions that were had a lot of high energy costs and leakage and so forth and so on. And NYSERDA did audits for us and basically told us what the costs were, where it was, the geographical impact. And it seems to be using the university and the community focus that it would be great, and it would, you know, you maybe start at a regional perspective, but then each particular municipality, you know, partakes in it, so it weaves into the larger. But these audits don't take that much time. And I really agree, will also include, you know, the impacts on the people and the communities that have been underserved. So that's A. B is, I really agree with the building codes and to the extent that we could look at just examples. Because we ran into them all the time at localities when we tried to put in solar. So is to, you know, look at that very specifically and what can be changed, because these old codes in whatever sector stop a lot of good progress. And then the final is, could you, you know, just examples of what you also in local codes, you know, what could be removed that are, is just clearly stopping progress, or where there's a conflict between state and local and how to address it. And I know that's not your panel, but it would be to do, but it would be great to think about setting that up. And that's both jobs and through universities and through community participation to ensure all. And that's it. I'm quick because I know lunch is looming.
Great. We definitely don't. Thank you. Thank you, Rose. We definitely don't want to get between anyone and lunch at this point. It's a long morning. On the audits, that's exactly the type of, I think, the type of hands-on assistance that we've sort of talked about at the local level, and you know, providing not just a grant, not just, you know, sort of guidance, but having folks, whether it's through a clean energy coordinator type of role, or it's an interesting idea to actually use universities to go in and help and, you know, really get that done at the local level so that municipalities have that tool going forward. So I think that's exactly right. That's exactly, and thank you for that sort of example of the type of thing the type of assistance that can be provided to localities, and it seems simple, but it's when you have, you know, we have our 700 or however many, I don't want to say the wrong number, but the thousands of municipal governments, we don't have, you know, they're just, it, people don't have the time and energy and capacity to do that independently. So that's thank you for that example. That's exactly the type of thing that we're talking about. And as far as you know, building codes go and sort of modernizing, I think that's something that energy efficiency and housing will talk a little bit more about. It's something that I know is on, you know, at Department of State, although it's not the area that I work on specifically. We work in partnership with that team, and I know it's something they're thinking about all the time. It's a building codes is a, you know, updating and changing the building code is a process. It takes time. It's not always easy, but sort of parallel to that is, you know, not only up, I think something that our panel did think about quite a bit is how do we ensure that as the building code evolves And as these requirements change, how do we make sure that that local governments are able to, they have the tools they need to implement and to realize these changes at the local level? Because, you know, building inspectors are, you know, often hired for an individual municipality, and they have, you know, and so how do we make sure they have the training, they have the tools, they have the assistance they need? So that is something that our panel thought about quite a bit. And I think you'll find energy efficiency and housing probably thought about it even more. But I think that's an area that's really important, sort of in parallel to modernizing the code, is how do we make sure that as the code is modernized, it's implementable, and we're not overwhelming, we're not overburdening under resource communities, that we're giving them the tools and allowing this to happen. And also, how do we ensure that we're not disproportionately impacting ratepayers, especially those most vulnerable? And how are we ensuring that these modernized building codes are able to be implemented without, you know, in a way that is equitable and that doesn't sort of disproportionately impact the folks who are least able to take on the additional cost? So it's a really, I don't have the answers, but I think you're absolutely right. Those are things that we need to be considering going forward. And I might punt a little bit to energy efficiency and housing and also to this council as a whole, but that's, I think those are very good issues, very good points. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
Hi, thanks for all the info and everything, all the discussion. My question is one of clarification. So the whole suite of recommendations is a lot about education, assistance, incentives, encouraging, empowering. Are there any of the recommendations that are mandatory, more in the mandates, rules side of things? And did the panel discuss that and decide that that's not their thing? Or was there a difference of opinion there?
I think it was something that came up in discussion. I believe you'll find that anyone else, any of the Paul or Brad or Laura, if you can think of, can you guys chime in if there were any mandates? I believe we defaulted toward, as you said, the incentives, the education, the sort of the incentive side. And the reason we did that is because local government holds certain, local government is responsible for making land use decisions. And it's in New York State, with so many different municipalities and so many different approaches, it's very difficult to begin to sort of mandate where incentives and assistance may meet the same goals. Paul, Brad, Laura, are there any mandates that we had that I'm missing?
Well, on the clean energy side, our strategy 3 calls for the establishment of statewide policies that require consistent advancement of, major building policies, like, advancing the energy code according to the CLCPA so that it aligns, establishing energy benchmarking and performance standards for buildings, creating innovative public benefit financing mechanisms that would probably require legislation. So there's a mix of things in there that, really it's about creating an approach that applies evenly across the board to local government, so that one local government adopting a sort of above minimum code isn't out there on their own and potentially at a competitive disadvantage because of the clean energy policies they have adopted. Part of this contemplates that the state kind of establish some statewide policies that apply to everyone across the board. And that was something we heard from local governments that was of high interest to them, not to kind of be penalized for doing something that's more advanced.
Helpful. Thanks.
Great. Okay, thanks, Peter, and then John, and that should take us to time.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. And thanks, obviously, everybody who participated in this panel. A really wonderful presentation filled with a lot of great ideas and recommendations. I have a couple of questions for you, and I'll try to be brief, but there's several, like I had with transportation.
On the issue of land use and sequestration, and this is apropos of Bob Howarth's great comments on seagrass and marshes, are we looking at sequestration for ecosystem restoration purposes and wildlife habitat protection, or are we looking at sequestration as a potential offset? Because, as you know, I think the ability to offset pollution is rather limited under the CLCPA. So I don't know the extent that the land use panel took a look at that question of sequestration for offsets or just preservation of open space for habitat and wildlife protection. Second question I have is, in the case of Just Transition, to what extent did the panel look at the role of community-based organizations? There are several wonderful examples of Just Transition happening in New York State, and I'm just going to rattle them off real quickly. Obviously, what's happening in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, led by UpRose with their grid. Clearly, there's a difference of opinion in New York City as to what should have happened there. Fortunately, the community-based organizations prevailed on what their community should look like. You've got El Puente doing the Green Light District, the Point CDC doing the Bronx Community Resiliency Agenda, and obviously what's happening in Push Buffalo. So did you contemplate a role for community-based organizations in implementation of Just Transition? I'm curious about that. Third, providing money for local governments. I was kind of surprised not to see a straight-up grant program. I know that there's a lot of technical assistance ideas with various state agencies, but I'm assuming local governments, you know, that are further along that don't necessarily need technical assistance from the state would benefit from a grant program, such as expanding the Environmental Protection Fund grant program or other areas where we could just directly provide grants for local governments through the law of implementation. Fourth, on the state energy plan, energy code, I just want to be clear. Are you suggesting that the statutory change that needs to be made there, that the agency doesn't have the authority under existing statute to update the energy code to meet sort of goals? And then last but not least, this one's going to be a little bit more granular, so bear with me, but I think you know where I'm going with this, Sarah. Is the intersectionality between what you said earlier about land use decisions and local control of land use decisions, was there any discussion anywhere along the way of the intersectionality between things that the state could be doing now that local governments may need to go through processes, et cetera, to change zoning? And the granular example I give you is gasoline stations. You know, are there things that the state could be doing that would prevent us from digging the hole deeper on climate pollution, such as giving permission or, granting permits for people to store gasoline and diesel underground through the LUST program. So it's that sort of intersectionality about where land use decisions and zoning take time to change, but communities aren't too excited about people trying to build more gasoline stations and not just upgrade them, but building new ones, which will set us further back. So hoping to have a little bit of discussion on those topics. Thanks.
Sure. Let's see. I start from, sequestration just quickly. I think that we did not, brief answer, we did not consider sequestration as an offset during our discussions. We really were thinking about, you know, preservation of wetlands and both coastal and inland as sort of smart growth protective measures. They have a resilience component that we discussed before. They do contribute to the state's overall carbon sequestration efforts, but we're not considering them as an offset. We really were considering them sort of more for their broader ecosystem benefit, all the co-benefits. So that's easy one. On Just Transition and the role of community-based organizations, absolutely. We actually discussed that quite a bit, including some of the examples you mentioned, specifically UpRose, Sunset Park is a tremendous example of the importance of community-based organizations. Also Push Buffalo, they've long been sort of separate from this process, long been a model that I think is worth replicating throughout the state. I'll go back to our Brantford Opportunity Area Program. Again, that's sort of one of the models that we were considering that does, it actually you know, you provide the assistance directly to those organizations sometimes instead of the municipality. So having community-based organizations as full partners in this process is something our panel was discussed quite a bit, and in fact, those particular models. Money grants for local governments. Actually, yes, we do. I didn't really talk about them. I realize now in this presentation, but we do have quite a few recommendations that for direct grants to municipalities. Some that just need grants. In fact, I don't know if you all are aware that the CFA, the Consolidated Funding Application Process, I believe is opening today. When it opens, we in fact have you know, in the effort of getting to this stuff now, we have the Department of State a new grant program to provide funding for local for communities, municipalities to do smart growth comprehensive plans. So yes, we in practice and in recommendation, our panel did consider direct grants and agreed that's part of the process. That's part of the need. Energy code. I don't think I'm in a position to answer exactly. I'm not exactly sure. You're just asking whether we have the statutory authority now to adjust the energy code.
Yeah, it's not clear from the written materials you sent earlier whether you need a change in statute. I mean, I think some of the things you might want to do, but I just don't know. You have the existing authority, or do we have to wait for legislative change?
I believe we have existing authority for most of the changes that are in our recommendations. Our recommendations about the energy code are a little bit broader than and a little less specific than some of those that you'll hear from energy efficiency and housing. But there is a process to updating the energy code, and that's in statute. So that process I know has to happen in order for changes to be made. But I hesitate to. Because it is not my area of expertise to comment too much more specifically.
And Sarah, this is Janet here. We can pick up after lunch on that very topic because we have addressed that.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you. Janet will answer all of your questions.
Is she going to answer my gasoline station question too?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So
no, just Janet.
Thank you, Janet. On the gasoline, I think it's a good question. I think it sort of speaks to the need to not be siloed and to think about how state decisions and state funding decisions and regulatory decisions have an impact. When I talked about not, you know, mandates, direct land use mandates are sort of different than what are we going to permit, you know, sort of on a state level, what are we permitting, where, how many permits are we giving, what type, and that obviously has an impact on land use decisions. So I guess it's about all I can, you know, not sure how much more I can add to that right now than to say that I think that there's a lot of nuance there in terms of what's required versus what's incentivized and how it impacts the local land use decision making. But when it is different to think about, you know, state permits and how those may or may not affect land use, local land use decisions, as opposed to, you know, saying we are now no longer allowing municipalities to permit certain things. So it's not sure if that answers your question.
We can always come back to that one. Why don't we move to John Howard, and then we're going to start session two at 1 o'clock on time. Okay, everybody, just for your planning purposes. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Ben. Well, thank you, Sarah, for all the one thing that over and over again.
You're breaking up a bit, John.
That one thing that strikes me over and over again, these recommendations seem to be in direct conflict with our state's constitution dealing with home rule. And over the last few years, we've seen really on large-scale renewable siting, I think the increased desire of the legislature to roll back that land use planning and give it to the state government. I think over time, issue of command and control versus voluntary or incentive-based decision-making will really come to loggerheads, the final CLCPA goals. And with the just take 1,200 townships in New York State, it's chances of them all being on the same page or the desire to give up any local authority in these things will become a very difficult, maybe irreconcilable problem going forward. But at least I do believe issue of enhanced building codes, and this is the first place to start, and having to go through it through the back door, being setting specific energy efficiency standards for appliances or particular building materials or things like that probably will not be as efficient as if we had one statewide plan and one statewide goal. Again, I do not see how all of these recommendations will be possible to meet our ultimate goals without some more on authority from the state, particularly for those local governments who may be more recalcitrant than others. But with that, thank you for your work, and got a lot of time between now and 2050.
Okay. John, you had the last word there. Given our time, and we have conflicts after 4 o'clock as well, so I want to keep us moving along. Doreen, anything to add before we cut for lunch?
No, other than please be back a few minutes early. We'll start promptly at 1, so you can just mute yourself, and we'll be seeing you shortly. Basil, anything in conclusion here?
No, thanks, everyone. Lots of ground to cover. We always have more need than we have time, but excellent morning. Thanks, Sarah. Good job.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Have a good lunch, everyone.